There's an NEDLAC process, Minister of Finance announced it's likely to occur in the second part of this year. Tentatively, they said July. But sometime this year, there'll be an NEDLAC process. Obviously, government itself is applying itself, two departments at least, trade and industry and our ministry. And we've come to no final conclusions, except that, yes, we accept this transformation. We think we need to speed it up to have more and more effective transformation. That's a majority view. The terms of it, the people happen, the way it will happen is something that a series of engagements in civil society, through government, ourselves, will shape. So in short, there's no like whatever you hear from a certain member of the opposition, let me assure you, he doesn't speak for the majority party. We have come to no final conclusion. It will be foolhardy for us to do so this side of a public hearing. Moreover, we're not just playing you. We actually sincerely want to hear from you. And we want to encourage dialogue and engagement. So those of you who can stay, even after you've made your submissions, please do stay. Thank you. I take it trade and industries committee secretaries are all functioning and there's no excuses. The documentation was sent out on Monday between 1:30 and 2 in 11 emails to finance. And I've been engaging with the trade and industry chairperson, so I take it everything's in order. Welcome, Joan. We got started. There's not much to say. I just announced in-house things. Our last in-house matter, well, it's not an in-house matter, really. It's a decision you need to know. Those of you who haven't been included in the first and second hearings will be included in the third hearings, which are now set for, Andre, are you listening, and Tando? On the 3rd of May. The chairs have agreed. It's Wednesday. We come back on the 2nd. It's a Tuesday. On the Wednesday, the 3rd will be the last hearings. Thank you. Over then, absolutely everybody who's applied will be included in the hearings, okay, both individuals and structures. The first input is from South African Reserve Bank. I see we have Kube and Naidu here. Welcome, Kube. I'll share mainly, Joan, the first half, and then you'll take over mainly the second half. Is that okay? That's fine. You're okay? No, okay. Welcome, everybody. Over to Kube. We're sticking to the time, right, as monitored by a stopwatch. But you're from the Reserve Bank, so you'll be good, I know.
Right, we'll be as efficient as we possibly can.
I see Unati is here, welcome.
Thank you, Chair, for those introductory remarks. For those who don't know me, my name is Kube Naidu, and I'm here in my capacity as both Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank and Registrar of Banks, and I'm joined by Unati Kamlana, who heads the Policy, Statistics and Industry Support Department in the Prudential Authority, the future Prudential Authority. Chair, I'm going to cover a specific aspect of the topic of these hearings, and that's why do we have a concentrated banking system? What's the historical context for the concentrated banking system? What are the advantages and disadvantages of a concentrated banking system? How do we mitigate the risks that arise from a concentrated banking system? So those are the issues that I'll deal with. I'll deal with the licensing framework, provide a little bit of data, but I promise to do all of that in 15 minutes, Chair. The mandate of the Reserve Bank, I think, is familiar with all the members of Parliament to protect the value of the currency of the Republic in the interests of balanced and sustainable growth, in particular to regulate and supervise the banks in South Africa. Through the Bank Supervision Department. We also supervise the payment system, and in terms of the Financial Sector Regulation Bill and a letter from the Minister of Finance in 2011, we have a role to play in the achievement of financial stability. So those are broadly the roles and functions of the Reserve Bank. Chair, I put up this slide for the sole reason to show you that there has been a significant reduction in the number of banks in South Africa since 1994. In particular, if you look at that top line, we had 40 banks at the dawn of democracy and 16 banks today, a significant consolidation. And I'll attempt to provide some explanations as to why this has happened and what the consequences of this are. We have not seen a significant increase in the number of mutual banks. We have, however, seen some strong, solid, and positive growth in the size of those mutual banks that do exist. And South Africa is well served with over 36 foreign rep offices, foreign bank branches, etc. So we've got quite a broad sophisticated and deep financial sector from a banking perspective. Just 4.87 trillion rands in assets of the banking sector. That's about 112% of GDP, which is fairly high for emerging market standards, but certainly not high in relation to advanced economies where it would range from 2 to 300%. You really get into trouble if you become Iceland and it becomes 900%. But that's a relatively high figure by emerging market standards. Chair, the picture on the screen has two lines. What share do the five largest banks have as a percentage of total assets? And it's about 90-91%. So the five biggest banks are very large. And then the total banking sector, the number of licenses, total banks and mutual banks are about 35 odd. So we have seen an increase in the concentration by this definition. And that increase in the concentration happened between 1998 and 2002. And I'll go into some reason why that happened. If we look at market share by assets, Investec at 8.2 and Capitec at 1.46, together with the top four banks would make up the big six, and those big six would comprise just over 91% of assets. If we're to put this picture up by customers, that picture would look slightly different. So Capitec has got 8 or 9 million customers today, many more than Investec, and so that part of the picture would look different. But this is the market share of the banks by assets. Between 1998 and 2002, South Africa had what we call a small bank crisis. We lost about 22 small and medium-sized banks in that era. There was no single explanation for why it happened, but several of the explanations include the impact of the Asian crisis and the depreciation of the exchange rate in 98 and 2001, bad management in some banks, some small banks being bought by larger banks, some people coming to the Reserve Bank and saying, you can have your banking license back, please. But we saw a significant reduction. Sambo Bank would have been the largest bank failure of that era. And it really shook up the financial sector in South Africa. The negative impact is that we had a more concentrated banking system. We would argue that one of the positive impacts is that we have a greater stability in the financial system. And Chair, that's one of the themes I want to leave you with. This dichotomy, this contradiction between stability in the banking sector and competition or concentration in the banking sector. The last bullet is important. While we have a dominant four-bank model, we certainly have growing shares by smaller banks. In some ways, the growth of Capitec is an example of the competition in the banking sector. They've gone from just over 1 million customers to about 8 million customers in a very short space of time. And they've also been quite aggressive in price. And we see a significant reduction in price across the sector in the last decade. Chair, this is some examples of concentration risks by other countries. So you see a rise in concentration and concentration risks in the range of 70 to 90% for most countries, both developed and developing economies. And that's partly because there are several things that push up the cost of banking. Regulation is one of those things. Technology and the capacity to compete at a technological level is a barrier to entry in that sense. And the global nature of banking has certainly changed. Chair, I put up this interesting slide, which is these banks consist of 90% of the British banking sector, the UK banking sector, and how it's moved from 1950 to 2015. So you had, about 30 or 40 odd banks that made up 90% of banking assets in 1950 to six banks that make up 90% of banking assets by 2015. So this process of consolidation and increased concentration in the banking sector is not unique to South Africa. Australia has four dominant banks, Canada has four dominant banks, and what we found is that there are significant advantages to having fewer large, well-capitalized banks. Their resilience to financial crises is one example. So these countries that have got fairly good banking systems that are well-capitalized, such as South Africa, Australia, and Canada, did not suffer from a financial crisis as the UK and the US and some European countries did. Large firms are better to withstand shocks because they're not monoline businesses. They get their revenue from a diverse range of businesses. So if you've got a fall in property prices, you may still be lending to the vehicle asset market. If you've got a fall in interest rates, you still have assets on your balance sheet that are less sensitive to that. And that introduces that third bullet, which is a concern that financial stability and competition or concentration risk may actually run in opposite directions, which introduces an interesting policy dilemma for policymakers, that a smaller number of banks that are better capitalized may lead to more financial stability, but there are risks on the competition front. And how as policymakers do we grapple with that? What are the risks of having such a concentrated banking system? Anti-competitive behavior is one possible risk. Creating what we call domestic significant important banks, significantly important banks, D-SIBs as we call them, or the too big to fail problem. So if you have got too few banks, they become too big to fail, and if they were to fail, the government will not have the capacity to bail them out, so that's a significant risk. Contagion risk. If there is a problem with any of the top six banks in South Africa, there is a potential of contagion risk. And we saw this with African Bank. African Bank had 1.7% of assets in the market, but the Reserve Bank intervened to protect African Bank because while it was small, the interlinkages with the rest of the financial system were so great that we felt we needed to intervene. And the buildup of systemic risks in a concentrated banking sector. So, Chair, what are the kinds of things that we do to mitigate these factors? We have a very robust and rigorous approach to licensing of new entrants. Last year we've given three new banking licenses, provisional licenses, to Discovery Bank, to Time, which is called Take Your Money Everywhere, which is owned by Commonwealth Bank of Australia, and the Post Bank. Each of those banks have received provisional banking licenses. They've got 12 months from that date to apply for their formal banking license. So this year, each of those three will apply. The pending introduction of a dedicated market conduct regulator, we think, will play a strong role in helping to curb market abuse in a dominant banking system. The resolution framework has been published and will come to Parliament late this year, early next year. We've got higher capital requirements in South Africa in general, but for the big banks, we have what's called a D-SIB buffer. So we force them to hold more capital because they're big and because it's a concentrated banking system. And there's a much greater regulatory burden on the large banks that we impose in order to mitigate those very real risks, Chair. What's the licensing framework for a bank? Any person may apply and the form is prescribed. You need at least 250 million rand of capital or 8% of risk-weighted assets, whichever is the bigger number. The registrar can set conditions, and significant owners have to pass what we call fit and proper persons tests. Senior board members and executive members have to be vetted by the Reserve Bank, and we grant the application for 12 months to register as a bank for us to be able to test their systems, audit their systems, see that they comply with all the requirements of the Banks Act. I've covered some of these issues. The last bullet is important. When we consider banking license applications or changes to ownership of banks, we are legally obliged to consider the public interest, and that does include transformation. It is certainly one of the issues that we look at. I think I've covered this broadly. Chair, I've got a few slides on the payment system that I've distributed because I think it's important to understand the role of the payment system in fostering financial inclusion, but I won't go into details of that. I want to conclude with the key theme that there is a trade-off between the concentrated nature of the banking system and financial stability. We would prefer a stable banking system, but we recognize the possible risks of a concentrated banking system, and we take deep account to try and address those risks. Let me give you two examples of where they've not got that balance right. So let's take Tanzania with 40 banks and Nigeria with 80 banks. They don't have a more competitive banking system and lower prices and more financial inclusion. Just because they've got 40 banks and 80 banks respectively doesn't mean that they have broader financial inclusion. South Africa beats them on financial inclusion. South Africa beats them on price. And so it is true that the concentrated banking system raises risks, but we think that we have a highly competitive system. We think robust oversight from the competition authorities is part of that equation. But at the end of the day, our objective is to have a stable financial system that serves customers, that advances transformation, financial inclusion, and access to financial services amongst all people. So, Chair, let me leave it at that and then take some questions from the committee.
Just to alert you that the state institutions have 20 minutes, everybody else 15, so you've used up 13 and a half, but you're fine with that, right? Okay. Right, okay. Is that fine? Good, okay. Then I gather from the Trade and Industry Chair that the National Credit Regulator, am I right, has decided to defer their submission until the 3rd of May. Is that correct? Is the NCR here? No, fine. Okay, so they will be here. All right, then we've got the BBBE Commission.
Chair?
You've got 20 minutes, yeah.
Just, I wonder, I understand that a decision has been taken for the National Credit Regulator to defer. Is there a reason for that, a reasonable explanation?
Thank you very much. Honourable Mania, they in fact requested to come twice, today and on later, but we do believe that we have to stick to the principle, and that is once only. And the reason why they wanted to come twice was to give a short bite now and come with a fuller research later. So really it's the research. Thank you.
Okay, shall we move on? We've got the BBBE Commission. Are you here? You'll introduce yourself and then... thank you. You've got 20 minutes. Thank you. Start now.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Honourable Chairpersons, my name is Zodwan Duli. I'm the Acting Commissioner for the BBBE Commission. Chair, we thank you for the opportunity to present today. I'm going to start first by just giving the background in terms of who we are, because we're presenting in this committee for the first time, at least in the trade and industry we have presented before, but we'll give just the background in terms of who we are. When we speak about BBBE, we're talking about a policy of this country that aims to enhance the empowerment of black people in the economy. We know that we do have a number of legislation that seek to advance that, including your employment equity, your affirmative action policies, and so forth, that seek to address the inequalities that exist in the that existed in the past. So the BBBE legislation is one of those pieces that comprise the integrated strategies to achieve that. So if we look at where we come from in terms of the equality issues, especially in terms of the equality in relation to access to the economy, active participation by black people in the economy, there's certainly a deficit. And that was recognized in the Constitution that was passed in 1996. So in the Constitution, it was made clear in Section 9 of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, that we need to advance equality. So the BBBE legislation, its basis is in the Constitution. So there is no question about whether this country needs to transform. there's no question about whether this country needs to change the fundamentals in certain market structures to ensure that black people can effectively participate. So we're not debating that anymore. That is recognized in the Constitution. So the BBB legislation was passed in 2003 to do exactly that. And in 2013, it was amended because from 2003, on review in 2011, there were a number of things that made it impossible to actually achieve what was intended. Key to that was fronting, which you know, we found in a number of sectors, but also the misalignment in terms of its application, as well as the lack of monitoring, which resulted in a lot of inconsistencies that basically made it impossible to achieve the objectives. So in 2013, one of the key features of the amendments was the introduction of a regulatory body that will then oversee the implementation, and that body is the BBB Commission. So our role is basically to ensure that this country can implement the BBB legislation in a manner that it's supposed to be implemented to be able to achieve the transformation that is necessary in our economy. And we do recognize as the Commission that we're not going to be able to achieve that by playing a lobby group. We're supposed to basically introduce certain measures in the industries to achieve what is required. So the legislation came into effect in 2015, and the codes were revised to align to the amendments in 2013. And we also have what we call the trumping provision. The trumping provision that is in the legislation basically means that if there is any piece of legislation in this country that is not aligned to the objectives that are in the BBB legislation, the BBB legislation will prevail. So that is the trumping provision that came into effect in October 2015. So it does impact a number of organizations, especially government organizations, that should actually align. Okay, I think I do have a challenge here. I'll work from my slide while that gets sorted out. Okay, now if we just go back again to say what exactly does BBB entail as envisaged in the legislation? We just need to explain that, Chair, and I will explain the reason as I go along so that people understand our mandate. BBB basically refers to integrated strategies that seek to increase, firstly, the number of black people that own, manage, and control productive assets, that control the market, that control the economy. And secondly, it seeks to facilitate the management and ownership by communities, workers, cooperatives, and so forth. This is the broad-based part of the BBB legislation. Also, in terms of advancing human resources and skills development within organizations. Further, it seeks to achieve equitable representation in all occupational workforce levels and categories. That's where the employment equity part comes in. And also then, what is critical is the preferential procurement from black-owned and black-managed companies. This is where government intervention and decisive strategies are required. And the last one is in terms of seeking to advance investment in enterprises that are black-owned or black-managed. So, Chair, if you look at what BBB seeks to achieve, you'll then recognize that it's impossible for this to be realized if the financial sector does not come to the party. And if the lending practices of the financial sector are not refined to actually support the development path of this country. So it is important that this discussion is taking place now, that we are looking at issues of radical transformation in this country. Chair, our mandate is explained in 13F of our legislation, which is the BBB Act that's amended. And I think key to that is the power to investigate and also intervene in instances of non-compliance with this legislation. This is what did not exist until last year. So the entity was established last year and is still in the process of being fully established. But I think what is important is that it didn't exist before. So if you look at where the market is at and what is happening in the market, we're beginning to see change, at least from the Commission side, because we're seeing a lot of companies coming to consult and seeking advice before implementing their BBB initiatives. Previously, they didn't do that. And you'll see that most of the BBB initiatives that were implemented did not result in the economic benefits in the black hands. So most of them would have lock-in provisions that delay the realization of the economic value, and as a result, it actually, I think it made a mockery of what BBB is supposed to be. So what you see is where, for instance, an entity will announce a BBB ownership scheme, but then when you look at the details of that ownership scheme, you find that there are so many restrictions in terms of their voting rights, in terms of the economic benefit that flows to those individual shareholders, such that when you actually calculate, the sale is cancelled off by the restrictions that are put on. So there is indeed no ownership. And so you'll find that for a period of 10 years, the entity will automatically recognize that ownership full points on their BBB scorecard, but actually there's no effective control over that ownership or the exercise of that right that comes with that ownership. So now with the Commission, we're able to go through those transactions upfront, look at them and advise where we find those types of provisions, and we think that this will add value to a number of transactions going forward. Chair, I'm not going to go through all of the functions, but I just wanted to introduce that function, and that it is a critical function, and we are receiving complaints, and we have investigated, and we are in the process of negotiating some settlements with some, and we are also preparing to refer some entities for prosecution. Chair, these are the elements that are involved when you talk about BBB in this country. The first element is about ownership. That is equity in the hands of black people. This is the part that I'm talking about. So when companies go out and announce those deals and they say this equity in the hands of black people, it's not about that glossy publication. It's about what's in it. So value must flow to the black hands. And so far, a number of transactions do not meet this requirement. But we find that they are actually recognized as such. So in terms of the BBB codes, the general codes, it's 25% minimum that is required from all companies. And you'll see, Chair, why we have a concern with the financial sector code, because it actually seeks to reduce this minimum requirement to further about 10%. With some top-up arrangement that we do not believe is going to advance transformation. The second element talks to management control. In respect of management control, we're also seeing here, Chair, that there's also a continuing tendency to seek to make black people tokens where they are appointed at executive positions, that their functions are stripped off. And these are the areas that we're also looking at very closely. We are being approached as a commission, mostly on an anonymous basis, by executives that are actually holding positions that appear to be executive, but they're actually not exercising that. So this undermines the achievement of what BBB seeks to achieve. Chair, the other thing about the management control is that it must be aligned to the economically active population as determined from time to time. We do get the statistics from that from Stats SA. And one thing about the financial sector code that is proposed right now is that they do not take this into account, and that is also our concern about this code, that it actually seeks to fragment instead of code making a coherent approach to transformation. The skills development element seeks to basically ensure that we are skilling black people, especially in those critical areas where black people were never exposed to. You look at sectors like engineering, nuclear, and so forth. Black people were never there. So some of these things are targeted interventions seeking to actually advance that critical skill in the hands of black people as well. And this will then advance their ability to actually move to manage and own some of these productive assets in the economy. The supply and enterprise development is the fourth element. which is also a priority element. So priority elements in this area are ownership, skills development, and enterprise development. Being a priority element means that if an entity does not do well in these areas and does not meet the target, then they do actually drop one level down. So these are important. Ownership, skills development, enterprise and supply development. Enterprise and supply development is intended to change basically the supply chain in various entities, but also it adds an additional avenue for black enterprises to get finance from the private sector other than going through the normal financial institutions. So it recognizes the value in an entity growing and supporting a new black entrepreneur to actually enter the market. And I think you would have heard from the deputy governor that one of the challenges, obviously, which is a barrier, is the cost in that industry. So facilitating entry through the support by existing players also plays a role there. The last one is the socio-economic development. This is what normally other entities mistake for CSI. Your CSI could qualify as this, but it depends on how it's structured. But this is an element that recognizes any initiative by a company which seeks to facilitate economic participation by black people. It's not donations. It's not any other stuff that entities used to do before. So it must be linked to the economy. So if you are an entity, you need to integrate all these five elements and have a strategy to be able to say how you're going to achieve this at the end of the year. So the challenge that we have found through our assessments since last year, Chair, is that a whole lot of companies just work on the scorecard. They do not have a strategy in terms of what is it that they're going to do in the ground to achieve all of this. At the end...
Julie, can I raise an issue? All of this is very good, right?
Yes.
I think we can add a few minutes, but you're at 12 and a half minutes, and there's a whole lot of slides you've got.
I'm not going to cover some of the slides.
No, but those are more valuable to us, because we're looking specifically at the financial sector.
Okay.
And I've browsed through it. It's very good, actually, or very useful. So I'll leave it to you, but you've got 7 minutes left, ignoring my half a minute I wasted of yours, right?
I'll leave it to you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I do see that it will be important at all times to start from the same basis as well in terms of the triple B, because at all times we seem to be understanding it differently, and I think that is one thing that actually affects the implementation thereof, and I think it's important that we play that role as well. So, Chair, in terms of this legislation, there are a number of things that we've identified as the Commission, which also apply to this particular sector in particular. The fact that the once empowered, always empowered principle was accepted in some point in the past, yes, it happened, and we're saying that it is not a good principle, and we're saying that it should not be allowed. It is not in the general codes, and it should not be allowed also in the sector codes. The reason being that it really regresses the country. We can't recognize ownership or empowerment that doesn't exist anymore. So if it happens and it's there, then we must recognize it. So we have a challenge with this, and I think it also creates confusion in the market. And then just in terms of the sector codes as well, we think that the sooner the sector codes are finalized, the better. The financial sector code in particular has been open for a while, so I think there must be a deadline to say by when it should be finalized, and I think perhaps this House will also give direction in terms of the timeline. And then in terms of access to finance, Chair, we recognize in every engagement that we have with black partners in various businesses, black entrepreneurs, this remains a challenge. And that is why I said the financial sector could play a role here, because a whole lot of exclusionary practices, a whole lot of rejection for entrepreneurs lead them directly to fronting arrangements, because what then happens is that if you can't get finance to acquire equity, then there's the vendor financing arrangement, which has got a lot of restrictions, and we think that the financial sector must come in to facilitate lending that will be reasonable for black people to acquire equity. In terms of the abuse that we see in terms of practices as well, again, I've indicated this, the multiple application of some of the concepts like the flow-through principles, the modified flow principles, but also the abuse of the collective schemes, especially where employees are involved, where employee share schemes are involved. And then the last thing that I need to mention, Chair, is the lack of integrity in the verification process. The nature of the relationship between the verification professionals and the clients that they verify is a concern to the Commission, because I think at the end of the day, we do not know whether the levels that we see on the certificates are worth the paper they are written on. These are the challenges that we are experiencing. But also, government is not integrating the BBB requirements in its own processes. I think when you listen to the Deputy Governor now speaking about the requirements for a banking license, the question would be, to what extent does the issue of BBB requirement, you know, plays a role in that first initial stage, not at change of ownership, but at entry level where people are applying? At what level do you take into account the level of black ownership in the entities that are applying for licenses? I think that is going to be crucial. So government must in itself integrate this. All government entities that are issuing licenses must integrate this, and at this point they're not doing so. Chair, in terms of the financial sector code itself, we've already indicated that our challenge is that we think that it's been open for too long. As the Commission, I've indicated that. And I think this process must actually give direction in terms of it being concluded. If it's not being concluded in time, then it must, the sector must revert to general codes and apply the minimum requirements that are existing. At the moment, it creates a whole lot of confusion. And in terms of some of the things that we feel should be revised to at least achieve some proper transformation, is that the financial sector code must align to the general codes.
You have 3 minutes left, but we'll give you some latitude.
It must align to the it must align to the generic principles that are contained in the generic codes, and at this point, it doesn't fully do that. And secondly, we also feel that the manner in which the financial sector code is drafted is denying exempted micro-enterprises and some qualifying small enterprises the benefit not to be incurring cost of verification. It still requires them to be verified in some instances because of the requirements that they have included. We think that the reason why we reduced the cost for small businesses and medium-sized businesses is to ensure that we do not unnecessarily subject our small enterprises to costs that can be avoided. So the sector code must deal with that. And also, Chair, we also find that the financial sector code that is supposed to drive transformation actually deviates significantly from what the general codes want to achieve. And in that way, it cannot be said that it supports transformation. In terms of ownership, I've already indicated that although if you look at the code, it sits still at 25% in terms of ownership, but that 25% is 10% and with some top-up, which indicates that if you're a financial sector player and you extend finance to a black entrepreneur, that could be recognized as ownership. And that cannot be. So we can't have the equity equivalent that is not done through the normal process of an equity equivalent program, which has got its own requirements. So we do think that they must make a stance in respect of ownership, which is real ownership. And some of the issues around lending, they can be addressed in the areas, in some of the elements as additional elements. And in terms of the bonus points that they're also proposing, that even when they're not even meeting the minimum requirement of 25%, they still award bonus points for achieving that less than minimum that seeks to be. And we think that this really undermines transformation. Chair, in terms of the management control, our concern is also, again, that despite the fact that Employment Equity Commission report indicates that the top and senior management in the financial sector still rest in white people. So over 60% is still in occupied by white people. So the management control aspect does not address this. And we think that a code must deal directly with the challenges that exist in the financial sector. It cannot be just broad and hoping to actually hit the target at some point. In terms of the skills development, again, we've noticed that also here they've manipulated the percentages to concentrate more at lower levels, when actually the main challenge is at top and senior management. So the pipeline, yes, it's important to create the pipeline, but if you don't have a decisive and committed strategy to really put black people on top management, doesn't matter how much effort you put on that pipeline, because you're not going to take it anywhere. So you continue to lose the people to the other sectors in any event, because you're not giving them opportunities. So if again, Chair, if they look at the Employment Equity Commission report, they will see that level, the lower level, is not a problem. In fact, that skill area, there's more black people there. So they must focus on the areas that they've got a problem. In fact, maybe they must ask themselves a question in terms of why they don't have so many black people at top management. What is happening? And if they are there, why don't they stay for long if they're not staying for long? Chair, the other thing about the preferential procurement, again, we see here they're deviating, and they're deviating downwards, and which is a challenge for us. Procurement is a key lever for us. And so if we are not getting a firm commitment for this from the financial sector, we do recognize that I was told in one of the meetings that about 90% or almost 90% of the procurement is IT-related in the banking sector specifically. And we think that they must have a strategy of unbundling that and make sure that they facilitate entry of black people in those areas. Chair, I think the last part would be the part about their socio-economic development. The one thing that the financial sector has included in their financial sector code is the issue of consumer protection, which is something that they get scored on, they get points on. So you can't get points for transformation when you're doing something that you should be doing anyway. So we think that if this was okay previously in the previous code, that was a voluntary code, it is not appropriate now. The main thing right now, we're not in 1996 when the Constitution was adopted. We have seen it's 20 years down the line. We know what is happening. We've learned lessons. So we need to accelerate. This is not going to accelerate. We can't award points for transformation when we're doing our normal course of business. So in conclusion, Chair, like I said, we acknowledge that the financial sector in South Africa, what is happening there in terms of the dominance and the concentration level is not unique to South Africa. But yes, we're saying that they are also obliged to commit to the transformation agenda of this country. And we're saying that we need to see that in action. We don't need to have a code that still supposes that certain things maybe can happen. We know some of the things did not work. So they must accelerate, they must commit to something that is concrete. The additional points that they've included, the empowerment finance as well as access to financial services. Empowerment finance, for instance, we don't know. Lending.
Sorry, I mean, you've gone quite far. Yes. It's not fair to others. Can you round up in the next?
We're rounding up. So we think that lending to a black person in itself does not warrant a point, but we actually
this one deserves 25 minutes. You know?
It's already
Chair,
it's not fair.
Let me wrap and thank you very much for the opportunity, Chair. But we think that Chair, this is an opportunity for the financial sector to offer something that is concrete. Thank you very much.
Yeah, can I just urge people to understand? Our researchers will read every comma and every full stop, as I said before, of what you've submitted. And we are familiar with a lot of these issues anyway. To be fair, I mean, if you look at the MPs here, we're very familiar with the issues. So with due respect to whoever, we have to be fair to everybody. We've said 20 minutes, 3 minutes above it is fine. But beyond that, I don't think, Comrade Chair, should we accept that wherever it is, right? But your input is crucial. Don't doubt that. In fact, on reflection, it would be nice to have had you at the first session, but it's the way it panned out, meaning, you know, I hadn't thought about it. I think Joan was more responsible for yourselves. But having said that, let's move to the National Empowerment Fund. You've got 20 minutes. Ms. Bidelezi, you're going to stick to 20, right? If you can, please. All right, thank you. Your brother's observing you, right? So you have to be cautious. Is he older? I'm not sure. Let me tell you, in the interest of openness and transparency,
Look, there's no rule such as this, right? So he sends me a note, and he says, just to avoid any conflict of interest, as if I don't know this, my sister will be here on the National Empowerment Fund. All right, on a more serious note, shall we get started? Welcome.
Thank you, honorable members. Honorable Eunice Karim, chairperson of the Standing Committee on Finance, as well as the Honorable John Fass, chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, and all honorable members, good morning, and thank you for this opportunity for the National Empowerment Fund to present its thoughts on the radical economic transformation of the South African's financial sector. As the two committees are aware, the NEF is the only development finance institution which is exclusively mandated to grow black economic participation in South Africa. Our presentation, therefore, honorable members, is informed by well over 12 years of the National Empowerment's operational involvement in transformation policy and implementation. And honorable members, just to give you a bit of background, before I joined the NEF, I had worked for quite a number of investment banks in South Africa. I started, my first employment was with Banque Nationale de Paris in London. Then I moved to the Reserve Bank of South Africa in the banking supervision arm of the Reserve Bank. Then I went to the investment banking arm of Standard Corporate and Merchant Bank. So I have a lot of experience in this sector. But in addition, honorable members, I'm one of the culprits. I drafted the BEE strategy, drafted the codes that were eventually adopted and passed by this parliament, and I was part of the drafting of the Financial Services Charter with my friend here, Cass, and the, yes, so I am a culprit in a way. So, honorable members, we'll just zoom into a topic that we are very passionate about because we've been observing some of the discussions that have already happened. So our presentation will focus on the ownership aspect of the Financial Services Charter. So let me first take you through the first wave of BEE transactions, because what's happening there will be a reflection on what we are seeing within the financial services sector as well. The first wave of BEE transactions were driven by the sale of non-core assets and a need for companies to conform to BEE requirements without the operational involvement of black people. So those are the transactions that we actually saw in the 1990s. The transactions were also highly leveraged and dependent on bull markets. So most of those assets or equity never really vested in black hands. The second wave, honorable members, which we propose, begins with the gazetting of the Code of Good Practice in 2007, which was driven by the buyout of stakes in existing companies. The transactions, once again, were highly geared. So the gearing here means there was more debt than equity that actually went into those transactions. This wave saw the prominence of lock-in periods to guarantee BEE status for the companies. The key drivers of the third wave, which is the wave that we are in at the moment, honorable members, was ushered in by the introduction of the amended codes in 2013, included among others the advocacy for and efforts to support the rise of black industrialists and the importance of localization. So, honorable members, now we're talking about empowerment that will actually lead to economic growth. It's no longer about the passive shareholding in non-core assets. And we are very excited about what we are seeing in the market. So in this phase, we see black people starting their own enterprises from scratch. And while some are pursuing preferential procurement opportunities from both the public and private sectors, others are pursuing opportunities in large-scale manufacturing and services, taking advantage of financial and non-financial support that is provided by government and DFIs in South Africa. Also in evidence is an appetite for what we call expansionary acquisition, so where black people will be acquiring assets which will actually lead to the expansion of the production capacities of the assets that they will be acquiring. Slide 7. So in this slide, honorable members, we seek to demonstrate the results of the misalignment of the interests between sellers, buyers, and financiers. In the first graph, the dividend that the black company receives is not enough to relinquish the debt, and as a result, the loan amount remains stubbornly high. So the loan amount, you'll see it in the green bars. So you can also see the discrepancy between the loan amounts and the dividend payouts. Such a situation would then lead to either the financiers calling their loan and exercising their securities, secondly, the transaction failing, or third, the transactions being refinanced. So this is what we call, honorable members, transactions that are currently underwater. We've seen quite a lot of these transactions. I'm mentioning these transactions because the financial services sector had a major role to play in terms of providing funding to those particular transactions. So what has happened, honorable members, is that a lot of black companies or black people would have acquired shares, especially in the mining sector. They would actually sit for 10 years without seeing any benefits from those particular shares. So this is what the slide and our research is actually showing us here. However, the opposite graph demonstrates suitable transaction structuring options, because we always say the devil is in the detail. So I really want to urge the honorable members to look at the financing structures, because that is, this is what has actually led to the quagmire that we are experiencing at the moment. You can see that the cash flows inflows are satisfactory in the second graph to relinquish both the interest and capital payable. In this scenario, the black company can realize equity values throughout the transaction, as demonstrated by the gap between the two lines in year 5. We've seen quite a few of these transactions that would be depicted through the graph. That's like Sanlam in the financial services is one of those transactions that are currently in the money. So overview of BEE ownership of JSE and the funding gap. So given the constraint that private companies are not required, honorable members, by law to publicly disclose their statistics, we are now using the JSE as a proxy to show the honorable members the current equity that is held by black people in South Africa. So we are just using the JSE as a proxy here. In assessing the JSE's top 100 listed companies to measure the level of economic transformation in South Africa, we find that black people still own a very small percentage of the total market cap. To illustrate this point, research conducted by Who Owns Whom reveals the significant direct black equity ownership that is controlled by black people to be sitting at around, or the total market capitalization of the JSE to be sitting at around 13.4 trillion as at 10 March 2017. So we find that black people still own a small or tiny portion of this, because we are currently sitting, or black people are currently sitting at about 3%, which equates to about 404 billion. So honorable members, we believe that if we're to reach at least 25%, so we're not saying 25% of the JSE, we're just using the JSE as a proxy. To reach 25% of direct black control, we require an additional 22%, which will be worth about 2.9 trillion rand. The 13% equity is also indirectly owned by black people on the JSE. So this will be indirect, like what we refer to as the mandated investments. This is what black people will actually hold through the pension funds, unit trusts, and life policies. but we need to go back to the objectives of BEE. When we came up with the BEE policies, we're saying we wanted to increase the number and the values of transactions and assets that are owned and controlled by black people. So that is why we actually don't focus on the 13%. But if we're to factor the 13% into the calculation, it takes the number to about 16% that is held by black people. Honorable members, this table shows the difference between the NEF 3% total direct black ownership of the JSE and the JSE's 10% black ownership measurement. It must be noted that the two studies are not directly comparable because they have different objectives. Our objective as the NEF was to identify areas where black people have significant direct ownership and control in the listed entities on the JSE. A requirement that was fundamental in the NEF study was for influence to be exercised through the ability of BEE shareholders to appoint and even to appoint directors to the listed companies in a bid to assess broad economic transformation in South Africa. Whereas if you look at the JSE methodology, their study was to identify all forms of value of stock market ownership. You'll actually see the difference between our numerator and the denominator, because the JSE has actually applied quite a number of exclusions, like foreign ownerships. They came out of their formula, and in a wide range of other issues. So the JSE methodology that arrives at 10% black ownership of the JSE is as a result of all black owned shares, but not necessarily controlled by black people. The methodology they adopted uses these black owned shares as a numerator divided by total market capitalization. So that's where the discrepancy emanates from. The respective objectives for the two studies were different and therefore cannot be directly compared. Slide 12. In preparation for the submission, the NEF analyzed the top 17 JSE listed financial services companies that have concluded BEE deals. Those are the major banks in South Africa. I think you have seen the slide. The total market capital of these top 17 JSE listed financial services companies is just above 1.6 trillion. On average, the deals were live for a period of over 10 years, and they actually included staff schemes, strategic partners, community, and charity schemes in their BEE transactions. The valuations done in the years between 2014 and 2013 indicate some level of net value created for the above-mentioned beneficiaries. And it currently sits at around 6%. That is the equity value that has rested in black hands within the financial services sectors. Slide 13. So we'd like to highlight some of the shortcomings of the FSC. Honorable members, there's no doubt that the FSC remains an important The FSC remains an important document. However, it is important to highlight some of its shortcomings. A fundamental deficiency of the Charter, honorable members, is the lower 10% target for direct ownership. So I think the Commissioner has already made reference to that. And then the 122 billion target for empowerment financing is based on the 2002 baseline and has now been reviewed, nor has it been adjusted to cater for inflationary increases, population and economic growth. So we're basing the 122 billion on a number that was determined in 2002, honorable members. Furthermore, although women constitute greater than 50% of the South African population, the Charter, honourable members, is virtually silent on the need to facilitate and enable the economic participation of women. If you look at the codes of good practice, in all of the different categories, there's always a set aside for women-owned enterprises. But it's very saddening to actually realize that we're not saying anything about women empowerment in the financial services charter. The women empowerment target is not explicit enough to drive the message that women empowerment is a critical lever for radical economic transformation in South Africa. Also, honorable members, the FSC does not allocate specific targets for the respective sub-elements under empowerment finance. In this presentation, we'll provide our suggested split to ensure that no sub-element is favored over the other. Slide 15. Allow me, honorable members, to now share the package of recommendations that we wish to table as the NEF to, so that the sector, which contributes over 20% to the South African GDP, may light the path for other sectors to follow as the vanguard for inclusive growth. In our view, honorable members, the sector's commitment of a cumulative 122 billion is too low for a sector that had assets estimated at 4.8 trillion as at end September 2016. Using the illustrative example of the 17 JSE listed financial services companies as a proxy to determine the appropriate amounts for empowerment finance, because, honorable members, this is the only category in our view that can lead to the economic growth, to the job creation, and which can actually assist the country to deal with the issues of poverty. We can deduce that, firstly, the market cap of the companies is 1.6 trillion, and they have done broad-based BEE ownership deals worth 65.2 billion, indicating that there is still a 4% gap in terms of the 10% FSC ownership. Since the 10% FSC ownership target is below the 25% that we have in the codes, the companies will have to spend an additional 204. So we are suggesting an equity equivalent formula that will allow the financial services sector to actually support black-owned companies in South Africa. We suggest that the 244.6 billion be invested.
Deborah, you're at 17 minutes, but we'll allow some latitude.
Okay, thank you. We suggest that the 244.6 billion be invested directly in the economy. We recommend a 61% and 39% split between targeted investments and the Black Industrialist Program. This will translate into the targets for both categories. Targeted investments and the Black Industrialist Program increasing twofold to 149 billion and 95 billion respectively, because we believe, honorable members, that the DFIs cannot or will not have the resources and the capacity to drive this so-called Black Industrialist Program. Chairperson, in the experience of the NEF, we believe that if you fund a woman, you fund a nation. We therefore propose that Black women participation be set at 50% for both targeted investments and the Black Industrialist Program, respectively. Furthermore, honorable members, the credit assessment models currently in use by commercial financial institutions such as banks typically categorize Black entrepreneurial businesses, particularly your startup, as high risk due to several factors, including but not limited to, firstly, limited to no trading records, no management information. So unfortunately, this so-called high-risk market segment, which would typically attract funding from DFIs, venture capitalists, angel and seed funders, has limited financial capital providers in South Africa. And this is where you can actually create a lot of value, honorable members. Slide 19. Accordingly, in 2007, the NEF identified this market funding gap and established the Strategic Project Fund, which provides venture capital to Black entrepreneurs. And through this venture, we've been able to actually create 22 live industrial scale projects that require 28.5 billion. So I have to say, honorable members, that the financial institutions have supported us in terms of rolling some of these projects out. The honorable members, especially from the Trade and Industry Portfolio Committee, are aware of some of the projects that we have even opened here in the Eastern Cape. A case in point is the Busa Capital in the Strand in the Western Cape. We only invested 100 million in that project, and it has actually attracted about 2.5 billion from the private sector. So I'm just showing this as a model for sustainable economic development. I won't talk about preferential procurement because the commissioner has already touched on that. Slide 22. So let me come to the proposal for the establishment of a black bank, honorable members, as part of a three-tier banking system, including commercial state-owned and DFIs and public and community banks, one that is directly owned by black people.
There's somebody taking pictures of us. Somebody's taking pictures of us, and I've raised this thing before.
No, they're entitled to do that. Is Frank Jenkins here? As far as I know, there's no rule against them taking photographs. Sorry? Not in the house, but I don't think it's... All right, fine. If you want to take photographs of the rest of us, you're free to do so, not Tandy, please, until we hear otherwise. Okay, right. So, just also explain, now that it's been interruption, that the idea, my friend, is that it's a public hearing, right, with due respect. And the idea was just to stimulate some thought. But nothing stops us, can I urge, because actually the last two submissions are like so key, yours and the one before, that nothing stops us from inviting them again, because they are state institutions, right? So what I'm just saying is that if you're unhappy with the time allocated to you, you can negotiate with Joan and me. We can bring you back. It's your state structures. You understand? This is really to hear the public. So don't feel... in fact, you're going to a very crucial part, right? So I'm just asking that we allow some latitude now that we're here, because it's talking specifically about a theme that the report will have to address beyond the post bank, a black-owned bank. So I'll give you 5 minutes, and then let's draw to a close, but we'll invite you again if need be.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. So, Chairperson, one of our recommendations, therefore, is the establishment of a black bank. We wish to emphasize that this would enhance competition and further complement current market offerings in the country. We envisage two approaches for starting the black bank. Option one is to identify one of the existing smaller banks and introduce products and services that meets the needs of black people, because we understand the market failures that we are dealing with. Option two is to start a new bank from scratch, and this shall require startup funding of about 306 million rand. So we've done our numbers. The bank shall provide affordable products and services that meet the needs of black people, such as business finance, home loans, and saving products, amongst others. Slide 25. One of the examples of an acquisition target could be Mercantile Bank, that has reportedly been put up for sale by its parent company, CAIXA Geral de Deposito. On 22 May 2012, the group bought out minority shareholders. So we're saying here is the low-hanging fruit. It has been put up for sale. You could take that and actually scale it up so that it actually addresses the needs of the black entrepreneurs that we are talking about, or black people in general. And as at 10 March 2017, the bank's total balance sheet was 12.2 billion, with 2.2 billion in capital, which equates to a capital adequacy ratio of about 19%. There are already interested potential buyers, but we are just flagging this as the low hanging fruit. We have also considered the prospect of African Bank being acquired by black people despite its recent hardships. So if you look at the shareholding structure on the slide, the bank is reportedly turning the tide following its demise and rescued by the South African Reserve Bank, the Government Employees Pension Fund, and a consortium of banks that own 50% is owned by the Reserve Bank, 25% by the GEPF, and 25% is owned by a consortium of banks. So it is a well-known brand that is supported across the country and has a network of 386 branches and over 1.25 million customers. So I'm just saying, when there are these opportunities, honorable members, where some of the assets are being put on sale, then maybe this committee can actually look at the possibility of selling some of those assets to black people, even if it was a small equity position that will be owned by black South Africans. So, Chairperson, throughout this presentation and in our submission, we have stressed the importance of raising funds through retail share schemes targeting black people and black groups. Because if we were to come up with a retail scheme, honorable members, there will be no need to even raise everything as debt from the financial services group. So the NEF has done quite a number of these retail share offers, like in our MTN stake. We actually sold 2% of our MTN stake that was valued at about 2 billion rands to about 87,000 beneficiaries in the country. So I'm just saying black people are actually looking for those investment opportunities, and they are actually sitting on a pile of cash. We actually raised 2.2 billion in 1 week from the general public. It was your miners, it was the nurses, it was the teachers, everybody buying a small share of what we're selling. So we're just saying this could be used as one of the models for actually financing some of these assets. Honorable members, we also encourage and support local ownership of our central bank. The SARB remains one of the few central banks that are still privately owned. I'm sure the honorable members will be aware that if you look at the central banks in Europe, a lot of them, if not all, are actually owned by the public or the government. So we're actually advocating for that as the for the ownership of small ownership. I'm not saying everything, 25%. I know that the SARB was never part of the financial services charter, but this is what we are making a recommendation for. So as it can be seen in the pricing graph, the share price has gone up, but if we're to, because we actually...
Can you round up now? Because we'll come back to you if need be.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're saying there is an opportunity for the Reserve Bank to be not everything, for black people to actually acquire a small shareholding of it. Lastly, Chairperson and honorable members, transformation has remained a voluntary process in South Africa, and we believe it has come more necessary than ever for all participants to comply with the codes as well as the FSC. The recommendations in this submission have the potential to enable the financial sector to drive the 3% plus in economic growth, and therefore to propel our country closer to fulfilling the vision of triple BEE policy and the NDP, the financial sector can and should push harder to alleviate the greater challenge facing black entrepreneurs, which is access to finance. Through empowerment financing and ensuring that women financing is equally prioritized, the financial sector can assist in the reduction of poverty and inequality, job creation, and restoring dignity to the majority of South Africans. There are strong and legitimate reasons to support the idea of a black bank that is owned, managed, and controlled by black people with the primary intention and focus to develop and provide financing in a hybrid between a formal bank and a DFI. The intention of the black bank would be to facilitate a strategic partnership through which government can enable market access and funding opportunities for black entrepreneurs. Thank you.
Over to members. How many want to raise questions? One, two. There's Tandi, Mr. Mania. Forget your name. What's it else? Hillwood. Sifiso Botelezi. That's it. And Brandon. Yeah. Hi. Right. Go for it. And Floyd. So 3 minutes, up to 3 minutes. Lisa, can you switch that off, please? Okay. Okay. And then there's also Mabe Pule.
Yeah, Chair. First, I wanted to say
to say to Cuban, it's not personal, but I missed
it. No, Mr. Speaker is allowed to do it. I've been photographed many times here.
Chair, I'm talking about the deputy governor.
Oh, I thought you were talking about that issue. Yes. So until we otherwise, you can take whatever photographs.
No, Chair, I'll point you to the rules that the committee is an extension of the House. I want Zuki to bring me a copy, because I don't just make empty statements, but I don't want to waste my time on that issue. I was saying to the deputy governor, it's not personal that I missed his presentation. At least I know what he said. I'm familiar with. And then I want to say to Zodwa. Chair, I want to say to Zodwa, I miss her, you know. And it's good that she's here. She should have got an hour. Because, you see, she's got a very difficult job, but, you know, because I worked with her on difficult projects, I know she will make it on this one. The commission, I pin my hope on it for transformation of the financial sector. If you don't do it, nobody else is going to do it, you see. So one of the things that I wanted to find out from the commission is that you mustn't do what the NEF is not doing. The NEF does not engage the financial sector thoroughly. Theory goes with practice. You must go to these people, engage them, make them understand the need to establish the state-owned bank. So I want the ENF to be a leading partner representing government to ensure that the private sector understands why we believe in the state-owned bank. Because its role is totally different. It's not a commercial bank. It's going to fund important projects that relates to job creation. So that one is a sealed deal. But secondly, Chair, before anybody goes for the NEF head saying that it's a sister to Honorable Sfiso, I hope in my absence he did declare. Because if it goes that way, we'll engage it. So it should not happen going forward. Here are the issues. One, I want the NEF to tell me how it has engaged the private sector in terms of selling of equity positions, right? Can you give us statistics on what type of work have you done? Secondly, what are the tackles that has been put in place in relation to breaking the JSC glass ceiling? We were told that in the current conjuncture, there's 25% shareholdership. That's not enough. So if you can tell us your programs as to how are you going to deal with it. Secondly, can we, even if it's not today, can we have information about the Black Industrialist program, the impact since its inception? What impact does it have? So 25% target, the financial sector only gave you 10% and say they broke even. I believe the 25%...
3 minutes.
Can I come back later then, Chair?
Yeah, if there's time, in fairness, yeah. Okay, next, you know, number two, whoever is number two.
Thank you, Chair. I direct my questions to the South African Reserve Bank. First, Deputy Governor, on the 15th of April 2016, I wrote to the Governor of the Reserve Bank requesting the Reserve Bank to investigate whether the relevant banks had complied with their obligations, international obligations and their obligations in terms of FIC and various National Treasury guidance notes in respect of the closure of the so-called Oak Bay Company's accounts. My question to you is, was that investigation launched? If it was not, why was it not launched? And if it was, what is the current status of that investigation? That's the first question. The second question is, I'm sure the Deputy Governor is aware, possibly as a result of my public statement, but hopefully as a result of a careful study of the relevant affidavits in the banking case, which will come before the courts this week, that it took Absa Bank more than 14 months to close the Oak Bay Company's accounts after their own decision to terminate the banking relationship. Now, does the Deputy Governor share my concern about that matter? And if he does, what is he doing about it? The third question is the whole question of the capacity of the Banking Supervision Department. If we look at the 2015 Banking Supervision Annual Report, the report concedes that one of the major weaknesses in respect of the banks is their capacity to conduct enhanced focuses and controls of politically exposed persons. And of course, my understanding is it's your department's responsibility to monitor and supervise that. But if you look at the statistics, over 4 years, the department only conducts six on-site inspections or routine on-site inspections of the large banks, and more worryingly, in 4 years, only conducts one non-routine on-site inspection, which suggests to me that your department either does not have the will or the capacity to properly supervise the banks. I wonder if you'd comment on that. Thank you.
Number three, please. Mr. Lewis. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson. My questions are also directed to the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank, and they relate to the difference between formulaic compliance with empowerment and substantive empowerment for the lives of ordinary blacks and predominantly poor black South Africans and their experience with the banking industry in South Africa. A number of times throughout late 2015 and 2016, I wrote to the Reserve Bank, various people at the Reserve Bank, asking for a full audit into the more than 2 million credit agreements in the African bank, so-called bad bank, and in fact both the bad and the good bank, asking for an audit for reckless credit, so that those reckless credit agreements could be identified, singled out, so that application could be made to the National Credit Tribunal for the writing off of those loans, and so that indeed those loans could be written off. Despite the fact that the Reserve Bank, agreed that reckless credit had in fact become a business practice and a business strategy at African Bank before its collapse, the Reserve Bank refused to support my call for that audit to take place. Fortunately, that audit has now been agreed to and is being conducted by the National Credit Regulator, but I think it's important to record that the Reserve Bank, when it had a critical opportunity to support the real substantive empowerment of millions of South Africans suffering under the burden of over-indebtedness, chose instead to defend the value and, in the words of the Reserve Bank, the collateral of its loan to that failed bank. But as I said, that audit is now underway and hopefully will be complete, and hopefully millions of those credit agreements can be written off because they are certainly reckless credits. Then my second question is to the BEE Commission. Ms. Ntuli, it's nice to see you again. The act that we passed in 2013 and which came into effect in 2015 allows you to initiate your own investigations proactively. And I presume you are able to pick up leads for those investigations anywhere you want, including from the media. And I wonder whether you have launched an investigation into what on the face of it seems like fairly blatant fronting by CPS Cashmaster Payment Services Net One in its original contract with the government 5 years ago, and in the subsequent empowerment deals that it has done since then. And Amabungani did a fairly extensive investigation into this and found some appalling evidence of what on the face of it again looks like fronting, and I wonder whether you have launched an investigation into that and whether you can update us on progress. Thank you.
Next, please, number four. Who would that be? Is it Brandon? All right, fine, then Sifiso.
Thank you, Reserve Bank Commissioner and NEF. Jay, what the presentation which has just been given us confirm one thing, that there's just no transformation in the sector, no matter which side you want to look at it. And again, it becomes very important for the financial services sector, because its impact doesn't just end with the financial services sector. All the other sectors get affected by what happens in this sector. So I think it's very important that we are spending time on it. The Reserve Bank, can you please say, just share with us the ownership of the South African Reserve Bank, right? And also please talk about its control, ownership and control of the Reserve Bank. Mantuli, good morning, good to see you again. You spoke about the net equity value. It's one of the things that you look at the consummation of a deal, right? Am I right that in most cases when you start a deal, the net equity value to PE companies, it's usually zero? And in the deals that one has seen, I've seen, because you'd see that that deal becomes a function of many things, amongst others, your interest rate payment, your dividend flow, and so on. And a lot of these companies, in that lock-in period, they just decide either to decrease drastically the dividend or not to pay the dividend at all, at the same time claiming all the BE points that they've finalized the BE deal. Come the end of the lock-in period, 8 or 10 years, you find that the net equity value flowing to BE participants is zero. But that company for the past 10 years would have had access to the state tenders, to the SOEs on the basis of a BE deal, which is not there for all intents and purposes. But I was checking with you is that when do you measure this net equity value? And what do you do when you find out that nothing has gone to the BE participants? The last comment, and something that I would really like you to consider, you know, as they say that, you know, when most of the things happens with the contracts, the agreements that the BE companies enter, I don't know whether you can consider having a section in the BE Commission, which looks at those contracts, because most of those contracts from day one, they are meant just to undermine BE, nothing else. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Brandon. Sorry, thanks, Mr. Chair. First to the Commissioner for BBBE. I'm very much in favour of this objective measurement criteria, something that we can use. And from that point of view, you spoke about the integrated strategy, and effectively I would understand that the elements of the scorecard make up an attempt to build an integrated strategy. My biggest concern is that there is a perception, and amongst members of this committee too, that for instance an empowered level one company has not done enough and shouldn't be considered to be doing enough in any sector, be it as the accountants that were here the other day, or as banks who are level two empowered and the accountants are level one. So theoretically it's an indictment on your commission. How do you defend that? I hear what you said about the sector charters is flawed and that needs to be looked into. But in theory, if we can objectively measure it, surely we've got to be able to rely on the empowerment level certificate which is given, or else we're going to have a problem. And I'm glad to see in your slide you said things about exemptions and exclusions for multinationals. Bear in mind that the need for foreign investment is very important. You know, when we consider that the banking sector's got 49% apparently foreign-owned, and that's considered politically to be white, we have a big problem unless we take into account this type of some form of an exemption. So, how are we going to defend the charters, not the charter, the actual code? Then for the NES specifically, I was concerned about the dividend tax increase and what it's going to do to empowerment funding. And Treasury argued there was no need for an exemption. How do you structure deals from the NES side?
Bear in mind, I would believe that most will rely somewhere along the line either on dividends or on some form of capital repayment. And then that links back to the lock-ins and the once-empowered, always-empowered principle, which I agree has its flaws. But the problem is if you put in lock-ins and force a shareholder that's been helped in some way to acquire those shares, to sell these shares only to a black person, etc., then that shareholding doesn't count as black either. So it's a horrible loop situation which we've got in this country. So if a company goes out of its way to empower its employees get enticed after 5 years to sell and make a massive profit and take it and put their kids to university and buy new houses, etc., now the company's not empowered anymore. And if we... So what is the Commission going to recommend that people do to maintain empowered levels? And then for the Deputy Reserve Bank Governor, the 49% shareholding of foreigners, is it realistic in any way that that will be reduced substantially over time? And secondly, is it even favourable to do such a thing? And maybe you want to share with this committee more about mutual banks. The requirement for mutual bank is only 10 million capital, and mutual banks can grow. And is it possible, for instance, to give black-owned mutual banks and black-owned banks, if we get to that point, some form of reduction in their fees and on reserve requirements without putting the whole financial system into jeopardy? My last point is also just the NAF on the side is the worst thing we could possibly do is make any black person a shareholder in the Reserve Bank considering basically pays no return. So we're not going to empower them in any way. So unless the Reserve Bank is restructured to make the shareholding have some value, it would probably be very a waste of the money to do so. Thank you.
Unusually exceeded 3 minutes slightly, but that's fine. It's not the end of the world. Who's next? It's Phule Mabe.
Thanks, Chair, I think that one of the few admissions that must be made is that the National Empowerment Fund is a dismal failure. And if you don't say that, you'll not be able to understand this, that since its capitalization expended 8.5 billion rands. That is possibly over a 10-year period. I think the NEF Act was passed in 1998. 8.5 billion rands in an economy of GDP of more than 4 trillion rands. In an economy which the banking sector only is more than 4 trillion rands. In an economy where assets under management are 8.9 trillion rands. And a board which is mandated with facilitating the redressing of economic inequalities that were shaped by apartheid has only expended 8.5 billion and must celebrate that. I think it's complete failure, dismal failure. It doesn't even scratch the surface. I think that is the understanding that, I've been trying to deal with this for some time in the Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry, that the conceptual foundation and the way in which the whole NEF discourse is approached is totally wrong. It's actually disgusting to think that you could empower black people with an agency that I think has got an annual budget of 2 or 3 billion rands. And it's actually 1 billion rands. Annual to facilitate the participation of black people in the economy, which has got assets under management of 8.9 trillion. I mean, like 1 billion, I mean, the expansion of a plant of BMW was 3 billion rands in Roslyn, just to expand it to perform certain functions. And all black people in South Africa must be facilitated into economic participation by 1 billion. I think that is one thing that I'm worried also that the NEF CEO is accepting that we must have the charter that says 10% participation is okay, we just have to handle some of the things. I don't think that it's taking us. I'm going to speak to proposals later of how that can be dealt differently. differently. I also think that the BEE Commission is useless, extremely useless, one of the most useless entities in terms of what has got to happen, because the legislation to some extent gives it teeth to could act on some of the issues, but they are still thinking of referring some cases for prosecution and everything else. But what makes the BEE Commission useless, it's I think a false conceptual foundation of trying to confuse the necessity of ownership.
I'm just being a bit more, yeah, make your point.
Yes, I'm...
I know where you're going, and I probably agree with
you. Yeah, I was going to help this meeting in a very huge way. If you could be patient with me. And you must remember that I serve in both the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry and the Standing Committee on Finance. Maybe you can treat me on that basis, that so that, yeah, give you 6 minutes, you know, so that I'm able to deal with some of those issues. That the conceptual foundation of mixing ownership with these other things that make most of the white-owned companies to be BEE compliant and high levels, of course, is highly problematic. Level 1, BEE, scorecards, whatever they call it, and all of those things. The white-owned companies, even the agencies that verify BEE, it's white companies. Approved by SANAS to, like, and there's a BEE commission which is supposed to be dealing with all of those issues, and nothing is happening. Now, the last issue which I want to speak to proposals, Chair, but I want to speak briefly about the Reserve Bank that... I think a significant component of it, we must discontinue the private ownership and allow state ownership, despite the fact that more or less now it operates like a state-owned company because 90% of its profits goes to the state. Majority of board members are appointed by the President of the Republic in terms of what happened. But there must be discontinuation of it. But lastly, Chair, is that I think that as the Standing Committee on Finance, we must have much more closer engagement with the Reserve Bank. The governor of the Reserve Bank, the new one, only came to Parliament once since his appointment. That is a matter of fact to the Standing Committee on Finance for an official report.
But if you were here, you'd know why. Floyd, that's irrelevant now. Bule,
and they can be.
Bule. Can you start, please? It's fair.
I was going to help you a lot.
You are close to 5 minutes, Floyd, because you come from, you're one person from that party, right? So we gave you some latitude. But the point you are covering, we have covered. There's nothing exceptional about that. What about conceptual foundations? I actually think you're making a very original point. But go on to Bule, please. Now, remember, you come from a majority party where there have been other speakers. So 3 minutes for you. The DA has had three speakers. EFF has only one speaker. Floyd, we'll give you a bit more time.
Thanks, sir.
But you also have to accept that, you know, we'll never finish otherwise. Just to alert members, by the way, despite the fact that one participant fell away and another used 7 minutes less, we are behind time. So I have to deliver to this chair by whatever happens at 1:15 lunch. Okay? That's the deal. So now, here it is. Pule, 3 minutes. And Floyd will give you 4 minutes, but no more in future. Or 4.5, to be fair. Right, that's it. Right, 3 minutes, Pule. Tandi, you speak usually for 18 minutes, right? You can do that in our committee. Pule, 3 minutes, please.
No, thanks, Chair. I think I will be shorter than that. It's just one on the BEE codes. You know this, and I tried to raise this question last week as well, that very often when some of these black-owned enterprises participate, especially in your government procurement, these days they've got a new thing on BEE where they can actually self-regulate, like they can do an affidavit. And in that way state whether they are level 1, level 2, or level 3. Now, that opens us up for not just fronting, but also fraud, because it means that whether it's a fully empowered company that uses wrong credentials, so that when they are assessed, either during a tendering process or during some of these equity deals, they are looked at favorably. Just wanted to check if they are measures to try and make sure that we kept those instances, because those things could also undermine the facilitation of empowerment, especially the enforcement of the whole triple BEE codes as it relates to government supply chain and how things are supposed to be done. The second one really is, well, I don't have the same background that Honorable Shibambu has on the National Empowerment Fund, but I think I must commend the NEF to have started what begins to posture on the radical economic transformation agenda as it relates to looking at ways and possibilities of establishing a black bank. And I think more importantly is, how do you marry that notion? Because 1 minute we talk of a black bank, the other minute we talk of a state-owned bank. So how do we marry this? Is the one going to do more of your retail banking, like a VBS, like a Itala, and is the other one really going to play a role that the central bank, like the Reserve Bank, is supposed to be? So I'm a little bit confused, because you Chair, sometimes you sit with people, you hear them talking about a state-owned bank. You know, the next minute it's a black bank. Well, without necessarily, and here I'm not speaking for the party I come from, but I think that it is part of what we should be doing to de-racialize the South African economy, is that we should grow to use concepts as well that are themselves beginning to bring our people together. Because I will tell you why. You know, we have got the Chinese bank in South Africa, which is the Chinese.
3 minutes, Pule. But quickly, 3 minutes. Just round up your point, please.
Yes, I'm just sitting on 1 minute already. There's 2 minutes safe.
No, please, Pule.
Okay.
Just round up.
Yes. No, I was just saying, as broadly, maybe you could assist us, the NEF and the people from the ones who are dealing with BEE could assist us that. What are we going to be doing if we want to truly deracialize the South African economy? Is it going to help us to only refer to sections, or we should be using concepts that are all-encompassing to make sure that we move this country forward? I mean, you could see, just the spare case, it's something else. It just gives it away.
Yeah,
and many other
expenses
that
would
be exposed on a daily basis.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Just looking at both the NEF and the BBBE Commission, I mean, the general point has been made that the funding model itself works against the principle of radical transformation and ensuring that the top grouping, if you like, layer of management and of ownership is in the hands of black people. And it would be constructive to have heard how we can overcome this. We've seen a couple of models put forward by the NEF, but it does seem as if we are losing out on a basic factor here, and legislation itself won't help this. We need everyone coming to the party here, entities as well as the private sector. Thank you.
Quickly, you have a sense of what MPs think, right? You can't reply to all the questions. You'll give us written replies within 10 days. The researchers have taken down every question. They will check when you reply that you've replied to every question. It's 3 minutes each, but before you do, a few quick questions. One, I knew this thing's going to come up. I mean, we all did, right? The questions you raised, Deputy Reserve Bank Governor, this tension between stability and deconcentration and all that, right? Ultimately, whose money? The banks don't own the money, so to speak. They own the dividends, maybe. But I understand all that. But what we are saying is that, look, maybe there's a tendency throughout the world for globalized, for banks to concentrate, 4 banks here, 5 banks there. But we're saying that this country can't afford that. Secondly, we're saying that, I don't know what happens in Germany, but I gather there's lots of banks there and so on. There are examples in Europe and elsewhere where it doesn't apply. We don't want you to reply now. I don't want my questions replied to. I'm just making some observations. I think you can reply in writing. And if need be, colleagues, we will bring... If need be, we will bring them back. Okay, are we agreeing on that? In fact, I think we should seriously consider bringing back the state institutions that spoke today in particular. Then I just want to raise this thing about, I feel, Reserve Bank Governor, though I realize the limited role of the Reserve Bank, that maybe you're not doing enough in issuing of licenses to check
on the transformation goals. I mean, you made that point, but it seems more like a genuflection. I agree with, I think, Ms. Ntuli. She heard you and she said the same thing. Okay, to Ms. Ntuli, you're very clear, very decisive, very strident almost. So, hey, why is it not happening? What does it say about the role of your commission, right? I know the financial and other problems. The same could apply to Ms. Mtetwa, right? That I know you're restricted in what you can do and so on. And I like what Floyd's saying. And I think when we look at the report, we should look into it and give him space to say what it is he feels is conceptually, the foundation itself is wrong. Not just about money, but the way it's structured. That's the sort of thing we can have an internal discussion about when the draft report is done. Maybe, Floyd, you can give us two or three paragraphs which we can insert into the report and look at, okay? No, because it's something new he's saying instead of repeating what we're saying in different forms, which is what normally happens. Now, can we move on? Doesn't matter who says it. You don't have to like them. I mean, who likes Mr. Mania yet, apart from his party members? But we have accepted things he said. So, really. Now, can we move on? Thank you. Don't answer my questions in verbal form. 3 minutes, please. We're very much behind time. Thanks to two state institutions' representatives here. We won't mention their names, right?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the questions I can't get to, we will send a written reply. Just on the state-owned bank, as I mentioned earlier, the Post Bank received a provisional license in 2016. They've got until, I think it's July, to apply for a formal banking license. They have been operating under an exemption. So they have 7 million people who have accounts, and they have about 7 billion of rands worth of deposits. Right? So that is on the cards. Mr. Mania, I'm not going to comment in public on any investigation that we conduct on any family or any group of accounts, whatever the circumstances are. It would not be proper for me to do that, to comment publicly. On the time that it takes for banks to close accounts, I want to point out that the intent of the Act is not to close accounts. Accounts should be closed as a last resort. If the bank feels that certain other steps have not materialized. In general, from what I've seen, it is a last resort, only after a particular point. But I think that that's the correct approach, that banks take time to understand the risk, to manage those risks, and only if the bank feels that they cannot manage those risks sensibly or cost-effectively should they close accounts. It should not be a standard practice that banks close accounts of people who they're suspicious of. It should be a last resort account. On the capacity of the Reserve Bank to implement our mandate in terms of the FIC Act, we are always going to be in a position where more resources would be better. But we have a highly effective team of supervisors. These investigations, these inspections are very intrusive. We are often at banks for weeks on end looking at reams and reams of data, of literally gigabytes of data. It is time-consuming, and we think we do a very good job of that. But it's not perfect. We do recognize that there are some capacity constraints, but expanding that capacity will take time. You've got to get the right people in of good quality and gradually expand that role. I am not uncomfortable with the capacity that we presently have and the amount of investigations or inspections that we are able to do, Chair. On the credit agreements in African Bank, it is absolutely not true that the Reserve Bank refused to support any investigation. The Reserve Bank made it clear that it is not within our mandate to do that investigation. It is within the mandate of the NCR to do that investigation. If any particular transaction or loan is found to have been reckless, then the NCR is within their power to instruct that the money, the debt be written off. But what we were opposed to was a blanket write-off because we felt that that would undermine the stability of the bank. On ownership and control of the Reserve Bank, we do have private shareholders in the Reserve Bank, but I think the Honorable Shivambu helped answer some of my questions. They have no real power to influence policy. They get a capped dividend of, 5 cents a share, and there's no real capital appreciation. So the government dictates the policy for the Reserve Bank, and the president of the country appoints the majority of board members. So ownership may be in private hands, but control is in public hands, and I think that that's an important distinction to make. On 49% foreign shareholding, I think the Barclays PLC sale of its stake in APSA will reduce foreign ownership. For technical reasons, the Nedbank Old Mutual managed separation would reduce foreign ownership somewhat. I'm not sure to what level.
Governor, technical reasons, right, you will. Reach 4 minutes. It's over. Thank you. I'll give you 4 minutes, Mr. Willie.
Chair,
in fairness.
Just on a point of order.
Yeah, what's that?
In response, the Deputy Governor says that it would be improper for him to refer to my to respond to my questions. But I wonder if he could tell me what authority he has in law not to respond to a question from a Member of Parliament of the Standing Committee on Finance. What authority in law do you have not to respond to those questions?
The same thing struck me, by the way. The same thing struck me, to be fair to him, that I was going to check it out with Frank Jenkins. You see, it's happening with the FIC as well. A lot of institutions in the financial sector appear and say they cannot answer. So it has nothing to do with Mr. Mania. I also thought about the same thing, and I was going to make an observation about it, which I forgot to do, which I would have done, sorry, and totally forgotten, but I would have come back to it at some stage. It's a fair question. Can you answer that?
Chair, the question was about a specific individual or bank, I mean, sorry, individual or family,
yes.
Right? Section 33 of the Reserve Bank does not allow me to divulge confidential information about specific individuals. It would be improper for me to divulge information about any specific individual, right, that could be market sensitive. For confidentiality reasons, it would be inappropriate for me to say, well, Mrs. X's account was closed, and these were the reasons why. Mr. Y's accounts were closed, and these were the reasons why, in public. It is up to the between the account holder and the bank to divulge that information, not to the regulator, Chair.
But, Chair, with respect, that was not my question. My question was simply whether an investigation has been launched or not. It's a yes or no question.
Yes, answered that, actually.
Whether you share my concern about the failure of ABSA to close the Gupta's bank accounts.
Yeah, that's a separate question.
Decision.
So. Yeah, that's a separate question. And that's a legitimate question. Remind us, what was your answer?
I stated that it is not the intent of the law to close bank accounts. Right. The intent of the law is to force the banks to take enhanced due diligence, to increase their scrutiny of suspicious accounts and account holders and transactions. And only after a particular point, if the bank feels that it is not sensible or cost-effective to continue with this enhanced due diligence, then they should have closed the accounts. The intent of the Act cannot be for a bank to simply be able to close accounts on the basis of suspicion. The hurdle to close accounts should be much higher, and I think that's correct.
Andy?
No, Chair, you see, if I follow principle with Floyd, I must be allowed to follow principle with David. You see, we said we need to be able to separate the issues that we're discussing. There's a reason why we're having this gathering. We're discussing transformation. Specific matters that need specific answers, we could have made arrangements for that. And the answer to David has been coming the same way for 3 years on the same issues, where SAB has been indicating to David that they cannot provide personal information of people in the public. But this question keeps on coming every year,
all right,
and we allow it.
No.
And that's it's on those bases
that I believe
we are not following
that's
a principle.
Fair. So now we're taking a decision. Unless you can come with legal argument to the contrary, we will not be allowing any more questions about individuals to the SARB. We're ruling on that. I was going to do the same, Tandi. As we've taken a decision in the Finance Committee, you're not going to ask the SAA person to resign. What's the name of the chairperson? That's done and over. You've asked it thousands of times. We don't have the time for that. Now, having said that, the Finance Committee needs to meet for 5 minutes when we break for lunch because of something affecting our program next week. I need a mandate. Right. Having said that, we'll give you up to 4 minutes, Ms. Ntuli.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, firstly, I must just indicate that the role of the Commission is to implement the mandate as it is in the legislation that was adopted by this Parliament. So the issues around whether or not ownership levels or ownership must not be looked in consideration to enterprise development and so forth, it's not my decision. We are implementing the codes as they are, and that's what it is. But I must say, Chair, that already in the legislation, the BBB legislation, where government feels that there are areas in the market where higher levels of ownership is required, government has the right under Section 10 to introduce higher levels, and those that can also be done in terms of Section 9(6) of the BBB legislation. So government has the power to increase those. So I did read also the article that Honourable Chibambu wrote around that Ownership Act. I'm saying to the committee basically that is already possible within the Act. Government can do that. Government has the power and the right to do that. So I must just emphasize that yes, the legislation covers ownership, covers all the five elements, but that's how it was adopted by this House, and I think we will implement that as the Commission. In terms of our engagement with the private sector, we are engaging with the private sector on various issues that we have raised here. In respect of the general opinions that we issue on transactions, upfront, we give upfront advice, and we actually are happy that we are seeing transactions before they are even announced and finally concluded by the parties. So going forward, we expect to see less fronting type arrangements in these transactions than we've seen in the past. So we're hoping for the best on that one. And then in terms of the SASA CPS contract, I must just indicate that we have requested documentation from SASA, and we will determine whether an investigation would be warranted or not. So we're just awaiting that. We've given them a timeline to provide those documents. And then in respect of the transactions, Honorable Buthelezi did ask about some of the transactions that we're seeing. We, in terms of the BBB Act, there is a provision that requires all BE transactions, major transactions, to be registered with the Commission. So that is going to allow us an opportunity to then actually look at each and every one of them as they are announced and concluded. But we're still waiting for the Minister to announce the threshold for that. So we haven't seen any at the moment on that basis. But we have called on specific transactions that we've monitored ourselves, and we have looked into them. We have issued three instructions to three major companies to correct their transactions, because we found that there were elements of fronting in those transactions, even if some of them were never intended, but they are correcting those. And as soon as they are corrected, then they will announce those. And then in terms of the, ownership, like I indicated, we look at all of those things upfront in those transactions. Hence, we have issued a statement to all entities to actually check with us upfront. We do have a section, the compliance section, that focuses on only those contracts, and they go through them and analyze them and engage with the parties on those. And then the last thing that I thought is important to also mention is the exemption around EMEs and QSEs, the affidavit issue. That was a decision that was taken, a policy decision, not the Commission's decision. The policy decision to exempt smaller enterprises from the cost of verification. So just to assure members of Parliament that really in terms of an affidavit and a certificate, there's little that actually we can say in an affidavit allows for fronting. So we think that it's a good initiative, and it must be allowed, and it doesn't take away the responsibility on those government departments to do their due diligence to see if the companies are not lying.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Simtetwa, you've got 4 minutes.
Thank you, Chairperson. So the first question relates to the questions that were raised by Honorable Tobias on why the NEF has not engaged the financial services sector on the establishment of a state-owned bank. Honourable members, I don't really believe it's our responsibility to do that. My view is that it would be the responsibility of the honourable members who are sitting here to do that. Because how do you, as NEF, you go to the financial services sector and you say to them, we believe that you should start a,
a state bank or a black bank. That's my view on it. Ours is to share our experience that we have in this particular sector and the expertise, because most of our employees come from that background. So we're sharing it so that the honorable members can take the information and then engage with it, unpack it, and then they will actually see what is actually fit for them. On whether we have engaged on the possibility of the sale of equity positions, we do provide guidance to quite a number of corporations in South Africa. When Sasol wanted to come up with a retail scheme, they actually came to the NEF. Sasol Inzalo was actually modeled against the MTN Asonge share offer that we actually did as the NEF. On the Black Industrialist Program, on its impact in the economy, the Black Industrialist Program only came about, I think, 2 years ago. But as the NEF, we had already started doing a lot of Black Industrialist Program. There was a slide that actually demonstrated that over 25 billion in value for Black industrialists has been created by the National Empowerment Fund. So from our perspective, but we have not measured the success of that particular program in the economy as a whole. Just coming back to the question that was raised by Honorable Shivambu on the establishment of the NEF, just to remind the members that the NEF Act was passed in 1998, NEF was only capitalized in 2005 to the tune of 2.4 billion. We have actually approved transactions that are worth 8.5 billion. Since the 2.4 billion that was allocated to the National Empowerment Fund, we have never actually received any additional funding from the South African government. Once again, it talks to the role of the honorable members on what their view and position is on the National Empowerment Fund. So, but also just to add that over a very long period of time that we have actually received clean audits. If you were to ask me about our capacity as the National Empowerment Fund, we believe that we could easily disburse 5 billion per annum if we were to be given the necessary resources, that a lot of black entrepreneurs are actually knocking on our doors on a daily basis. We actually receive about 1,000 applications per annum, which talks to the need from our black entrepreneurs. And then on the dividend tax increases, the structuring of our transactions going forward, we are happy to provide a written response because we must show you how the SPV structures and all of those. On the sub that if black people were to acquire a shareholding, it would be a waste of money. It's just the significance, really, and the oversight responsibility. And the required funding for the equity positions that we are referring to is actually very small. But it actually brings us much closer to the monetary policies of the country if we're to be able to do that.
We have follow-up, some of us. No, Chair, but this is not fair. You allow David to engage, so... No, Chair, but David has asked three more questions, and here is the perception on what I said, and I don't have a right to reply.
Do you people want to finish at 19:15, or are you prepared to stay longer? Right. Can we get a mandate? Who wants to stay beyond 19:15 today? Right. Secondly, who wants to reject the process we have in the Standing Committee on Finance, which the Ministry has agreed that people will respond in writing? Right. Thirdly, is there any problem with the chair saying that if it's a small party which has got one person, they'll be given some latitude, the remaining parties have got more than one person, and they will stick to the 3 minutes? Right. For your interest, Tandi, the one chair spoke for 57 seconds, and the other chair spoke for 1 minute, 27 seconds in asking questions.
And David?
David was entitled to do it. David, you can do it again. So can any member of... He was right to ask an issue. He raised a point of order. It was correct. Even one of the chairs thought, under what rule are you doing it? I would have asked
it
anyway.
A point of order right. To the head of the NEF.
All right. So what is your point of order?
No, you see, here, the head of the NEF, when she makes a presentation, she speaks speaks on policy matters on the need for the establishment
now,
of the bank.
This is a public hearing for the stakeholders and the public. The idea was for them not. I think we allowed too much of latitude to you. Maybe you should explain. This is for the public. You are state institutions. You account to the Trade and Industry Committee at least once every quarter, I imagine. So, and many of the things with due respect, right? These members, except for the new members, knew what you were saying. So actually, the state institution should behave. This is about the public. They can be called here again. So, Tandi, I'm asking you to think about this. Should we invite the three again? You think about it, we'll do it, but not at the expense of stakeholders from the public. So now can we hand over to the National Association of Cooperative Financial Institutions of South Africa. Where are you? Are you here? Thanks, my friend. You've got 15 minutes. Yeah. Thank you. We have got your submission here. Can you start, please? Introduce yourself and start, please. Your time starts right now.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Mzwakhe Skhosana, the managing director for NAPFISA. I'm accompanied by Dumisa Mkhwata, a board member of NAPFISA. NAPFISA is the National Association for Cooperative Financial Institutions of South Africa. It was established in 2013 and since also under the Cooperatives Act of 2005, and it is in line with the Cooperative Banks Act of 2007. The establishment of NAPFISA, it is to represent registered CFIs, to represent cooperative banks, and also cooperatives that aspire to be financial cooperatives. We want to build a strong, viable association. And our mission is to unite, lobby, influence legislation, and also provide financial and non-financial services. We enable CFIs and cooperative banks to be self-sufficient and sustainable, and we also want to promote access to skills, finance, and values of good governance. Now, our mandatory objectives, it is lobbying and advocacy, because we want to create access of knowledge to government agencies about cooperative banks and what impact they play. We also want to emphasize advocacy in terms of the cooperative banks model, as opposed to the current financial models that exist. We also want to make sure that NAPFISA is recognized as a representative organization for all cooperative banks in South Africa. We also, number two, our objective is institutional capacity. We want to make sure that we capacitate cooperative banks in South Africa and CFIs that exist throughout the country. Objective number three, it is provide a management information system, like a banking platform, because the cooperative banks do exist, but they do not have the technological capacity to transact on the national payment system. But we will talk about that when we go down further on slides. But we've also got our own little program which manages the information systems to try and make sure that the sector has at least integrity and transparency in terms of financial transaction. And the last objective is to promote the image of the sector of cooperative banks. I mean, the current image is that we are village banks and we are not sophisticated, so forth and so on. But we're also doing that because there's also a lack of marketing through our government agencies that are responsible to promote the image of the sector. And we also want to lobby in terms of the usage of the name bank, because it seems like the word bank is being monopolized by the current banks that exist, and there's a tendency, or there's more like a notion that cooperative banks must call themselves CFIs or any other name except bank. We we also want to make sure that there's at least professional branding for the sector and make sure that everyone knows what is a cooperative bank, so forth and so on. Now, quick facts about cooperative banks. They are under the Act of the Cooperative Act of 2005, and there's also a Co-op Banks Act, so we are all aligned in terms of the legislative environment. We have different names, community banks, village banks, savings and credit cooperatives, but more or less we are the same thing. And these are the principles of cooperatives. The principles, most importantly, it has voluntary and open membership. It has democratic member control, members of economic participation, autonomy and independence, education, information, cooperation between cooperatives, and most importantly, consent for community. So cooperative banks are composed either community-based or they are association that forms cooperatives, or they are employer-based. A certain employer would then have their own cooperative bank, or it's a mixed system. So this would be the composition of how a cooperative bank would look like. Now, the quick facts in terms of where are we in terms of cooperative banks in the country. Since 2010, we've had 121 registered CFIs within CBDA. CBDA is the Cooperative Banks Development Agency under the National Treasury. Now, you will see that there's a decline from 121. We are now standing at 30 in terms of the statistics we have in terms of 2015 and 16. In terms of membership, we've had 59,000. We are now standing just under 30,000. So this means that there is a systematic decline of cooperative banks in the country and of CFIs because of the agencies that are supposed to promote and build the sector. It shows that this is declining a lot, and not much effort is being done on. Now, we've been looking through the Auditor General's findings in terms of the information that we have. I mean, we find that there is material misstatements on the reported performance information of supervision, which is 38%, and capacity building 40% in terms of the Auditor General's reports on CBDA. And the material findings, they find that targets were not reliable when compared to the source information and evidence provided. And a total of 38 and 40% respectively of targets were not specific and measurable. So it's basically an indictment in terms of that the agency, in terms of its mandate, deliverables, and what they have delivered has not actually met or met the requirements that were supposed to be there to develop the sector. Again, the CBDA did not establish or manage a cooperative bank's deposit insurance in accordance with the requirements of the Section 25 of the Cooperative Banks Act. So that is also critical in terms of the decline, because other CFIs that exist that may have needed financial help or any other capacity in terms of making sure that they are still alive today, and we find ourselves that they are dead as we speak. So. And then again, we also look at the executive authority did not take the requisite steps to fully align the entity's mandate with an enabling legislation. Remember, the Cooperative Banks Act exists, and the legislation wants to promote and build more cooperative banks and CFIs, but currently that is not happening. So the accounting authority did not take requisite steps to adequately review the annual financial statements and annual performance report before submitting them for auditing. So those findings are all existing in terms of the Auditor General's reports and so on. So we want to highlight that as one of the quick facts. This is a quick fact from NACFISA in terms of how we are alive today. In terms of our own statistics, we have 55 CFIs. Within South Africa, they are all geographically dispersed throughout the country, and we the sector has more or less about 320 million rand versus the reports that we get from CBDA that the sector has 279 million rand. But we'll elaborate in terms of why. We've got two cooperative banks of the 55 CFIs. Because now the legislation in terms of being a cooperative bank, it rests with the Reserve Bank, and you find that only two are qualifying. But we can safely assure you that there may be two cooperative banks, but they are not participating in terms of the national payment system. They are not within or registered within the national payment system. They don't have debit cards, they don't have credit cards, and so on. So we'll talk to that. Now, only 30 are regulated by CBDA, and 25 are not accounted by CBDA, because CBDA simply chooses to work with people that they want to work with, and if you don't ship in, then you must ship out. This is the model, the CFI model, or the cooperative banks model. The owner becomes the shareholder.
Can I just raise something? Don't you want to focus on your recommendations very quickly?
Okay.
We're at least 18 minutes behind time. It's not your fault, but we can't give you more than 15 minutes.
All right, no problem.
Carry on.
Okay. Now, this is the model. The shareholder becomes the owner, and the shareholder can use the group savings in terms of borrowing and repayment. And the shareholder, because it's also a customer, receives interest or in terms of the savings interest or investments and shares. And everyone who is, everyone can be a member of a cooperative, from individuals to cooperatives to stock firms and SMMEs. Now, differentiating characteristics between the current banks and also the cooperative banks. We've put in about 19 characteristics there, looking at ownership. Mostly in private banks, it is foreign and also private cooperatives, it is local and broad-based. Directorships are appointed, and in cooperative banks, directors are democratic. The motives for normal banks are for profit, high in terms of charges, interest deposits are low, and penalties are also high, but it is quite different in terms of cooperative banks. Most importantly, the sustainability model of banks, it is high indebtedness, and cooperative banks, you use your own money, so you've got financial freedom. The morality is low in terms of banks, and it is high in terms of cooperative banks and so on. So we also look at many other things. Decisions on products, fees, and charges, they are done privately in private banks. And in terms of cooperative banks, they are done through an AGM. Concern for community is one of the principles of cooperatives, which is number 7, and it is discretionary in banks, but it is mandatory in terms of the cooperative banks. We look at many other things, capital flight risk, bailouts, and all of these things. So you would find that information that, especially if you look at the German model, the private banks were bailed out in the financial crisis, but the cooperative banks were never bailed out because they were simply a sustainable model, and it proves that we need to focus on that. Now, this is the CBDA's or the Treasury CBDA's in terms of their vision and mission. I want to drill into that. I think we can look at that in terms of their things within the website. Principal reasons, we feel that there is a lack of political will within Treasury, and also the players, the referee and the player within all of these things. And most importantly, we think those things need to be changed and so on. Now, we've outlined reasons in terms of why the sector is failing and what needs to happen. Most importantly, we need to highlight that we've had an institution like this, NACFISA. It was called SACOL, but now we find that SACOL has died, but the same people are now operating within the CBDA, so they're supposed to find out in terms of who and what happened, but those investigations are not transparent as we speak. Now, our model as NACFISA, this is a solution that we want to present. We want to establish each and every cooperative banks in each and every municipality, district banks, and all of these different tiers, they will serve a different function within this system. Because we feel that cooperative banks, they lie within the communities, and communities and wards, they develop in terms, they will develop in terms of if we assist them forming cooperative banks and so on. Now, most importantly of the recommendations is that we want to make sure that CBDA comes back and reports in terms of what they've been doing since 2010 and what's happening now, because it shows that there were 121 CFIs, now we've got only 30. So we feel that there's a systematic killing of cooperative banks in the country. We want to demonopolize the word bank so that we can also use it as cooperative financial institutions. Give financial cooperatives a representative organization, which is NACFISA. So we want NACFISA to be recognized, to be also empowered in terms of financially also to be given an auditing authority within the system, so that we can be able to build our sector and make sure that we make very important decisions that build the sector, because the sector is under attack, as the statistics would show. So this is a way of transforming the economy radically. And also part of our recommendation, we want to make sure that the Act allows for members to deposit or invest more than 1 million rand, because now the Act doesn't allow that. So there's always a cap in terms of what a cooperative bank can do as compared to a normal bank and so on. So we want to make sure that legislation changes to enable a proper environment for cooperative banks. So, but we've shared the presentation with everyone. I think they will be able to read into that. But most importantly, government must intervene, and then this committee must intervene, because the cooperative banks are being systematically killed. We've applied for a banking platform. 30 million rand was allocated through DEDs and so on. That money went to CBDA, and it's 2016 now. We still 2017. We still don't have a national payment system, so we need to find out what happened in terms of that. And in conclusion, I mean, the NDP states that South Africa has a potential and capacity to eliminate poverty and reduce inequality over the next two decades. And our model is aligned with that. And you have to build in terms of active citizenry and make sure that people are the champions of their own development. And this cooperative model allows for that. So, for the time that we
give. Thank you very much. Rush you like that. I really am. Because we're very interested, many of us, in cooperative banks. And it's something that SCOF needs to, and Treasury needs to look at again. Next then, thank you very much, is the National APEC, if I'm right. Yes, Cooperative of South Africa. Where are you? Yeah. Is it yourself? Sorry, can you start making your way? Who's DGRV? Ludwig Erhard. Where are you? Can you start in the meanwhile? It doesn't really matter. Let's start here. You ready? We've got a submission from you, is that right? Yeah, then we can start while that's being done. Alan, can you help there, please? Right, can we start? We'll have you next, if you don't mind, Mama. Right.
Okay, can I start?
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Good day. Good day, Chair, and good day, Honourable Member of Parliament, and ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ludwig Erhard. I am from the German Cooperative Movement, and we are working on an agreement between the South African and German government, and we want to share our experience about cooperative banks and cooperatives, and we think we can show you an answer or an alternative. But that's why I want to talk about the cooperative model and cooperative banks, how we are doing it, how we see the financial transformation and how we have done it. I think it's a good possibility not just to look to South Africa, also maybe look a little bit abroad, because if you go to strong countries, not like in Germany, also if you go to maybe Japan or to go to Europe, the United States, America, North America or South America, even if you go to the BRICS country, Brazil, Russia, China and so on, they have a good cooperative model. And this is missing. We have a hell of cooperatives here in South Africa, more than 100,000, but they're not working because they're doing it in the wrong way. So that's why we are here, try to share our experience, but we have a hell of problems. But let me start a little bit slowly with a fairy tale, and then you know what we are talking about. So there are fish in the sea, in the sea, and everything is fine, but as soon as there are danger, then what to do? So, and without a lot of words, it's more or less self-explanatory. So then, if you group together, then you can even fight a big fish. So this is what we want to promote in South Africa all about. So as an individual, you are nobody, but to go together in a cooperative way, you have a chance to be successful. Okay, I don't want to go back to our history. It is Raiffeisen and May Schulze Davis. Maybe you have heard about it. We are promoting the self-help principles and self-responsibility and so on. So even, and then what is important that our organization, the organization is important. So we have to group the people together and form an organization. That's why we are supporting NACFISA and NACSA. And then, but let me go back to DGRV. What is DGRV? DGRV is what should become NACSA in South Africa. It's an international cooperative apex organization, and also is an auditing federation. So we have four groups, four pillars: banking, agriculture, craftsmen, and consumer pillar. And we have just not 100,000, we have just 5,000-6,000 cooperatives, but more than 80 million members. So I'm proud to represent almost 20 million Germans here. Yeah, and all my cooperatives, they are very exciting. What happens with the cooperative sector in South Africa? But unfortunately, there is little progress. German cooperatives are more than 150 years old, so we have a hell of experience. What we are doing here in South Africa, we are supporting, like I said, NACFISA. It should become the national body for cooperative banks, CFIs. Then, okay, we have BIGSA, that is also they're working with bakery cooperatives. That is a small project, but it's successful. And then we provide a hell of cooperative training courses together with small business. And then, we are supporting NACSA. And then we also asked in Swaziland, Lesotho, Zimbabwe, and Zambia. So this is just the four pillars. The left pillar, I just want to highlight from your side, the left pillar, it is the banking sector beside the sector of agriculture, consumer, and also small businesses. And also at the right side, there is a housing sector. This is all, it's more or less under the umbrella of DGRV, the German sector. And it's quite organized because there is a clear mandate from the government. It's on top, and then it goes down to the national federations, which are missing here in South Africa, and also they are somehow, proper structures are not in place. Okay, and finally, very important are the local cooperatives. And this is, we called our multi-level approach, so it's a top-down, up-down, but at the right side, as written, related based on subsidiarity principles, so it must come from the local, from the member, from the ground. So bottom-up is important. And then I don't want to go so deep in non-business functions, so these are the functions of the secondary level. And then I want to go to the cooperative bank sector. So this is we need a whole sector to be successful. So we need cooperation, and we need a lot of partners in the cooperative sector. So we have round about, that is not my presentation actually, but we have a whole of network. So we have a central cooperative bank, DZ Bank it's called, and then we have, because of a special function, so we have also in our cooperative sector special insurance and special institution. They're working with housing loans because they are high risk, because they are long-term loans. Then we have also easy credit, there is from consumption, and then if you want to invest and so on. So it is all in order to make the cooperative banks competitive. To have also what also the private bank has, you have to have a full set of services. Otherwise, you won't compete, and you won't you will be always small and useless. So since our membership, we have round about 17. We have now, that's not my my presentation, but we have around about 20 million members, a total balance sheet of almost 1 trillion. And then this is how our customers are distributed. So most of them, they are employees, also pensioners, and also others. The others, they are mostly they compromise of small businesses. So what is important to have a clear structure and to be specialized? Just to give some factors. So to be strong in the market, you have to be strong, and if you're not, and you have to be profitable. If not, then you have to emerge. So, and then you have to have equal and fair competition, and especially now what's missing in the CFI, so cooperative bank, professional management, and members who are aware of the duties. Yeah. And then integration in a strong cooperative organization. I jumped that a little bit, but at the end I wrote independence from state. So what we see here, so most organizations here, they are government orientated. You need all organizations, banks or enterprises who are market orientated. Otherwise, you will have dependency, what you see in South Africa, and you have to get rid of it to be successful and have a strong basis. Then, what can cooperative banks achieve? It can achieve that the people on the ground, this is missing in South Africa, they can participate. They can participate successfully. Let's participate. Let's bring. They should deal with their problems themselves. So the cooperative model can assist with that one. It's not that they always say they're looking to the government and asking for the government. We are doing a hell of cooperative training, and then the people say, "Yeah, cooperatives are something from government." No, they like my colleague had said, they are autonomous, they are independent. So they have to realize that one. But if there is no proper organization or no proper federation to tell and to help them, then they won't understand it. And ownership is important. Then if you implement cooperative banks and the people have their own bank, you don't have to destroy or dismantle big banks. So let's compete, and you can compete. So the people have savings, but they have to deal it in the right way. Let them do it themselves, and they will be successful. The cooperative model will help to do it. So bring this problem down to the people, and not just government people. So there must be organizations which facilitate these possibilities. So, and then, then you are create. If they do it themselves, you create accountability and responsibility. This is missing. And then or she, sure, you have to provide good financial services. So at the end, you will have, if you let the people do it by themselves, then you will solve a hell of the problems. So our cooperative sector has around about 20% of the financial market. So, and it doesn't solve all the problem, but it solves a lot. So you have to diversify. It would be good if you can diversify the financial market of South Africa. So like with cooperative banks, we have 20% of the financial market, but if you go to other countries, they have even more. If you go to Austria or to Canada, their cooperative banks are much, much stronger and they have more portion of the financial market in the country. So this is what we want to share. Thank you for your attention.
That is, oh, we see the spirit of time. Good. Over to you from the National Apex Cooperative of South Africa. FinTrust has fallen away, FinMark Trust, the Nedbank Next. Thank you very much. Okay, we can start from now. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, Deputy Chair, Honourable Members. My name is Annie Mujane, and I'm from NACSA. My focus is really going to be on the topic, transformation of the financial service sector, really talking about from a cooperative perspective in terms of self-help and creating economically inclusive communities. Before I do that, let me just give a brief background about our organization. I'm representing NACSA, and it stands for the National Apex Cooperative of South Africa. We were founded on the 25th of June, 2016. Currently, NACSA consists of 25 tertiary cooperatives, and Apex is formed by tertiary cooperatives. We've got one secondary operating nationally, and they just presented here. That's NACFISA, and we are made up of a board. Now, our vision, very quickly, NACSA, we are the voice of South African cooperatives, united in building a vibrant and inclusive cooperative economy. Next slide. Now, what is it that we're focusing on? It is important to constantly remind ourselves, honorable members, in terms of where we come from. We're sitting with a serious apartheid legacy that we cannot continue to sweep under the carpet insofar as the economy of this country is concerned. The economy is such that those who were previously advantaged are still advantaged and wealthy in terms of the economy, and those who were impoverished are the black majority, and they continue to be impoverished. And that is why we're sitting here today, so that we can propose alternative models in terms of empowering and creating wealth for the black majority of this country. Now, what we are suggesting, now, looking at the South African landscape, and especially insofar as the financial sector is concerned, we all know that there are a very minor percentage, if you can even call it percentage, of black people participating in that financial sector. We need to create a sustainable, inclusive, cooperative ecosystem, and that will be made up of these pillars: the culture of self-help and self-reliance. We need to really have serious conversations about this in South Africa, and not only have conversations about it, but also have the political will and political support that it requires. Education, skilling, coaching, mentoring is a very critical pillar. We often hear, even in the old days, when even Mr. Mboweni was even still the governor of the Reserve Bank, and he would say that South Africa, we're not a saving nation, we don't have a saving culture, and that is also a critical pillar. In the morning, we listened to the BEE Commission, as well as NEF, talking about ownership and transformation of the industries, and especially there of the banks. And of course, the fifth pillar is access to affordable finance services. Now, we believe that, I'm basically repeating the slide that my NACFISA colleague presented here to the House, because it is such an important slide. The entire morning, we've been listening, sitting at the back, and of course we know as a country that we've been pleading with private sector to transform, but they're not going to transform. We've seen that they are not transforming. In fact, we believe that they will not never transform. So instead of pleading with them, let us create alternative systems that will serve the majority of black people and the impoverished in this country. And this is our model. Cooperatives, right at the bottom, forming their CFIs, but also the CFIs must not be in the current form. Because currently, when you form a CFI, you still have to go and bank with APSA, with Standard Bank. How does this empower you? Basically, you are a glorified stock firm. So we need to be able to convert those CFIs from being glorified stock firms into properly empowered financial banks, as my colleague referred to. Then we formed those big three banks, and I'm happy that my colleague from the DGRV actually spoke before me. I think it worked out well, because now the House has an understanding of this particular model. Then we go a level up and form those provincial banks, and we are strongly advocating for a cooperative bank, you know, as opposed to just a black bank. Because if we're talking a black bank, We know who, what market that will serve. Fine, that black bank can be formed, but it will especially serve your middle class. And it's not going to do much for the majority of impoverished people in our country. So the cooperative ecosystem is what we are strongly advocating for, because eventually we'll then end up with a national cooperative bank. That is what we are strongly advocating for. Because in terms of ownership, there are no questions. In a cooperative, members own the cooperative. So there will be no qualms in terms of who owns this, members own this, and that is important. I'll go straight to the recommendations. Just before the recommendation, the function. What will be the functions of this National Cooperative Bank? We'll be able to actually serve our members and also give the commercial banks a run for their money, because we will provide the services that they are providing only because we'll be owning these banks. It will be at favorable rates. So the whole package and suite that we'll offer is very much similar. Wholesale production loans, large investment loans, development funding loans, asset acquisition finance, cooperative business restructuring finance, bailout and mergers, finance, that is so important. As we know that a lot of our people are blacklisted, and if we have our own bank, we can relax some of these requirements. Credit and deposits insurance, insurance including health and insurance products, mobile payments and e-commerce administration, the establishment of deposit guarantee funds, the establishment of solidarity funds, which is so important within a cooperative environment, the establishment of an audit fund, that is also very important. Now, how do we achieve this? It's well and good to sit here and say, would like this, and this is the laundry list, but it's also important to make some recommendations. We recommend that within the current legislation, obviously, we're advocating for some changes within it, because as it sits, I've already demonstrated to you that a CFI currently banks within either FNB or Standard Bank, and it can't continue this way, because how are you a bank within a bank? I mean, I'm sure that as a group of people here, honorable members, who are quite well-informed and intelligent, to know that this is not banking. We are just continuing to enrich the current banking system. So kindly give an APEX recognition as supporting and representative organization of all cooperatives. Give an APEX mandate to be a cooperative verifying authority of all compliance related matters. Give an APEX mandate to be an auditing authority and supervisor of all cooperatives while the state keeps regulatory responsibility. Because currently, you know, as my colleague pointed out earlier, that all sits with CBDA. There's a referee and the player at the same time, and it's not working for us. Given APEX mandate for administration, disbursements, and collections of funds meant for cooperative support, including stabilization funds, deposit guarantee funds, etc. Given APEX mandate to oversee disputes, fortunately, if depending on when this piece of legislation is going to be promulgated, we're just waiting for the regulations to be signed off by the president of the country. We've been waiting for quite a while. There's also in that particular act different measures in place for disputes. My last recommendation is that APEX be given the mandate to collect that information and compile sector performance reports. That is very important. So with that, I believe that it is time in South Africa that we took the cooperative banking model seriously, juxtaposing that to what is happening currently. We have really been pleading. We've been praying even for private sector to change. Private sector is not going to change. Here is a model that is working in other countries. We've just heard the Germans presenting to us. But if you look at the whole world, the cooperative banking is taken so seriously. It's only in South Africa that it's not taken very seriously. So it's one thing to have a piece of legislation, but it's another to actually have that political will, walk your talk and support it. I thank you.
Thank you very much. Ned Bank, you want to come over there, please? Thank you. Brown, you can get started.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Honourable Chairperson Karim and Fats, and to members, Honourable Members of the Standing Committee on Finance and the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. I'm Mike Brown, I'm the Chief Executive of the Nedbank Group, and thank you for the opportunity to present on Nedbank's transformation journey to date. Nearly got the slides up and ready for you. You have our detailed submission with you. It goes to about 50 pages, and what we're going to take you through now is 22 slides, and I will speed through them relatively quickly so I don't fall foul of the time record. I'm joined today by a number of Nedbankers, including our Chief Operating Officer and Executive Director, Mfundo Nkuhlu, Exco member Tolani Sobeko, and other members of our team who will stay with you throughout the afternoon. For Nedbank, transformation is more than compliance with any codes. We see it as both a moral and business imperative. Nedbank strives to fulfill its role in South Africa to transform our country and in so doing to remain a growing and relevant part of society. As stated in the National Development Plan, transformation is central to reducing poverty and inequality and for our country to progress. Transformation needs to catalyze higher levels of inclusive growth. Nedbank, as a responsible corporate citizen, is committed to playing our part in transforming and in so doing, to improve the lives of all South Africans. Our approach to transformation is both disciplined and holistic. This slide on the left-hand side sets out the eight elements of the FSC that members should be familiar with, but on the right also highlights other vital elements of transformation to us, such as our brand, stakeholder relationships, leadership and cultural change, as well as the impact of aspects of legislation. Our transformation journey is guided by our board-approved transformation vision, which you see at the bottom. It is for Nedbank to be a pan-African bank with an inclusive culture, relevant in the societies in which we operate, and admired as a business that significantly advances the development of historically disadvantaged people across all of our stakeholder groups. Transformation is not something at Nedbank that is separate from our strategic framework that you see on this slide. It has been embedded into it. Our business has a purpose, and our public purpose is to use our financial expertise to do good for individuals, families, businesses, and society. Nedbank also has a vision, which is to be the most admired financial services provider in Africa by staff, clients, shareholders, regulators, and communities. And you can see here that transformation is an enabler on delivering both our vision and our purpose. This for me is a particularly important slide, and I hope you can see it on the screens, because it provides a 10-year view of our transformation journey, which is an integrated strategy to both transform and grow. And as you heard last week, while it might be difficult to aggregate data at an industry level, Nedbank certainly has very accurate data of our own transformation journey that is both reported on and monitored. If you go to the top left, which is sustainable financial transformation, you can see the headline earnings of the bank over the last 10 years improving from $4.5 billion to $11.4 billion. If you look at the middle graph on the left, which is an entropy score, which is a degree of disorder in your system, it's a cultural survey that we do across 20,000 people in the bank every year, and because it's a degree of disorder, like a golf score, the lower the better, and you can see significant improvements over that 10-year period. In the bottom left is our FSC or DTI scores, all externally audited with no self-certification. You can see that our score in 2006 was 56.6, and that's improved to 98.6 in 2016. Our FSC score is currently the highest of the peer group, albeit that we recognize that this is only one measure of transformation. You can also see on these slides that in 2008 to 2012, when some people think that the FSC died, we managed to increase our score from 82 to 95. Now, FSC is also score is competitively very important to us. Like all the codes, the higher your FSC score, the higher the procurement points that your customers can earn on their own scorecards. So the more likely they are to do business with you. On the right-hand side, you can see over this period that the value or market cap of Nedbank increased from 60 billion to nearly 120 billion. Our employees moved from 24,000, of which 58% were black, to over 32,000, of which 78% are black. Our clients increased from 3.5 million, where less than 50% were black, to 7.7 million clients, with 78% black. We've also increased our number of ATMs and branches to provide access. So these collectively for us represent our transformation journey, which I humbly believe represents broad transformational progress over time, but with more still to be done. Undoubtedly, this transformation journey has made Nedbank a better bank today than we were in 2006. Just to highlight the integrated nature of our transformation journey, this is a slide that I presented about 2 weeks ago with our annual results presentation, looking at the transformation as evidenced by the stakeholder groups on this slide. So if you look in the top left, we employ 32,000 people, all of whom earn well over the minimum wage, and they contributed just over $3 billion in taxes. We have created 4,000 jobs since 2010, and many more indirectly. From a client point of view, last year we paid out 162 billion rand in new loans. 26 billion of that went to SMEs and business banking clients, nearly 4 billion to affordable housing, and we have about 50 billion payouts and funding commitments to infrastructure, which is a vital driver of growth in our country. We safeguarded 760 billion of the nation's deposits at competitive interest rates, and we processed more than 15 billion transactions so people can pay for goods and services. From a shareholder point of view, we have a diverse shareholder base, with the Government Employee Pension Fund currently owning 6% of Nedbank. From a regulatory point of view, our balance sheet is strong, meaning we are safe and secure, which is important for our clients and important for South Africa. We paid last year in cash taxes 5 billion rand, and we have invested over 100 billion rand in government stock, enabling the government to fund fiscal deficits. I'll look at our community performance a little bit later, other than pointing out here that our efforts have enabled us to maintain level 2 status for 8 consecutive years. Transformation forms part of our board governance structures and is a strategic enabler led by the chief executive, the board, and the executive team. As you can see on this slide, we have a dedicated board subcommittee, the Board Transformation and Sustainability Committee. For many years, this was chaired by Gloria Sorobi before she retired from our board and is now chaired by Nomabusa Nkosana. It's supported by numerous executive committees that you can see here on the slide. And collectively, this governance structure ensures ongoing diligent tracking, measurement, and monitoring of our progress on our transformation journey, including all our data and assumptions. Our board, I said, is ultimately responsible for our transformation program, and it itself is well transformed. If you look in the top left of the slide, you can see we have 3 executive directors of the bank, 2 of whom are black, and 1 is a black female. On the top right are our non-executive directors who are not independent because they sit on the Old Mutual PLC board. Our chairman, Vassi Naidoo, who is one of those, is black. Across the bottom, if you look at our independent non-executive directors, they are 10, 7 of whom are black. Only 6 count in terms of the FSC codes, as David Adamarco is non-South African. If I shift to our ExCo team, the transformation of this team has also been an ongoing focus of ours, and it currently consists of 13 members. The executive directors in the top left-hand corner I've dealt with already. In the top right, you look at people, what we call running our client-facing businesses. We have 1 white female, 1 white male, and 1 black male who runs our retail and business banking operations, which is where 20,000 of our 30,000 staff reside. Across the bottom, you can see the ExCo members running our central clusters. 4 of the 7 are black. The detailed highlights of our transformation journey are contained in your full submission. So in the interest of time, I'm going to go through the next few slides quite quickly to show some examples of how ordinary South Africans have benefited from what we do. On ownership, our broad-based BEE deal was recognized as one of the most successful deals ever done. There were more than 500,000 beneficiaries, including our clients, our staff, and black business partners, who were involved in our business via business performance contracts. This transaction realized over 8 billion rand in cash, debt-free, and free of any other encumbrances. Some of that has now been reinvested in either other businesses or legacy projects, like the agricultural project in Kentani, which I'll talk about later. Under the FSC codes, adjusting as allowed for mandated investments and the see-through from our parent company, Old Mutual, our audited, measured, black, direct and indirect shareholding by Sizwe and Saluba Gobodo under the FSC was 37% in 2016. The audit certificate is attached to our detailed presentation. Nedbank, like almost all big banks, as you have heard, is institutionally owned, being foreign mandated investments 18%, domestic institutions 76%, including Old Mutual earning 54%, our Ayetu empowerment scheme still holds 4%, and individuals or retail investors own only 2% of the bank. If indirect ownership via pension funds and institutions is excluded, our direct black ownership is 5.44%. Turning to communities, our innovative affinity programs have since inception donated a total of 360 million rand at no cost to our clients to good causes they choose to support. This includes 74 million for the vital work of the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund and 240 million to support the World Wildlife Fund and the work in the environment. Our brand has also deliberately been transformed from elitist to a bank for all through our sponsorship of Inter Alia the Nedbank Cup, with the Reality Kiona team search giving many youth the opportunity to fulfill their sporting dreams. Our dedicated focus on measuring and monitoring employment equity has led to a workforce that has black top management at 54%. That is well ahead of the South African percentage of 28 per the 2015 Commission of Employment Equity report. And our pipelines are also strong. Black middle management is at 60% and black junior management at 88%, both of these above the South African average for all businesses. In addition, following the questioning last week, 63% of our staff are female and 55% of all of our managers are female. The long-term foundation for economic growth is education, and our country has numerous challenges in this regard, particularly in maths and science. We have had a long-term focus on contributing to that, as you can see on this slide. Our enterprise development is focused on small and medium enterprises. As we know, these are the engines of economic growth and job creation. We do this both ourselves, as well as in partnership with government, other businesses, and global entrepreneurs. We provide financial education at a large scale. It is a vital building block for anyone to become financially independent. These workshops are delivered in all official languages. As mentioned earlier, in 2016, we lent over 160 billion in that year in new loans. This slide shows over a longer period what we have done in each of the key categories under the financial sector charter. 6 billion for transformational infrastructure, 11 billion in affordable housing, nearly half a billion in black agriculture, and importantly, 17 billion for black small and medium enterprises, a big focus of this committee. We've also lent nearly 30 billion in financing BEE transactions in other corporates, facilitating increasing black ownership. We have financed over 55,000 affordable housing units, and we also focus on procurement. 75% of our procurement is local, so if we take the total procurement last year of nearly 11 billion, 2.5 billion was spent on 367 black-owned suppliers and 1.4 billion on 205 black woman-owned suppliers. And you see here an example of a black woman-owned cleaning business whose turnover increased from 300,000 to 15 million as a result. For banking to be accessible, it also has to be affordable. In 2005 and before, Nedbank was strategically focused at the top end of the retail market, after making a mistake in the late 1990s of closing a number of accounts in pursuit of being a high net worth and corporate bank only. Since 2005, we have focused on being a bank for all. And this slide here shows that in 2006, 7, and 12, we had price cuts in our retail banking fees, and in 2014, we had no price increases. We know we have more to do, and our commitment to transformation going forward is informed by the learnings and challenges of our journey to date. So what have we learnt? We've learnt that by embracing diversity, Nedbank is a better business. We've learned that transformation needs to be integrated into the strategy and culture and led by the board and the chief executive. We are transforming ourselves and play a transformational role in society. And in so doing, we become both a better and more sustainable bank. Measurement and communication is key, and we need to remain focused on sustainable transformation over the long term, because there are no shortcuts.
Brown, your time's over. Can you just type in 30 seconds at most?
So certainly there are some challenges, and we recognize those, in particular in supplier development, African senior management, and black SMEs. This is my final slide. So I hope that what I've been able to demonstrate to you in this short presentation is that we are committed to advancing transformation for South Africa, its people, and our business. Transformation is embedded in our strategy and is not just about compliance. We have made progress, as is borne out by the audited data since 2006, but know we have more to do. We thank you for the opportunity to engage, and Nedbank certainly looks forward to working with this committee in its future endeavours.
Questions, comments, how many people? Mr. Mania, Brandon, Mr. Connor, Comrade Sifiso. With 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, EFF 6. Okay, in that case, 3 minutes is fine. And no more than 3 minutes, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I just have one question which I'd like to put to Nedbank. Nedbank CEO would be aware that ABSA and Standard Bank received invitations from the ANC as part of their investigation into the closure of the Gupta's bank accounts. And in the case of ABSA and Standard Bank, they evidently decided to cooperate with that investigation and also meet the ANC, despite the fact that the ANC is not an official investigating body and is not an official regulator of the banking sector. So my question in respect of Nedbank is, did Nedbank receive a similar invitation from the ANC, and what was Nedbank's position? Did you cooperate with the investigation and meet the ANC, and if so, why? Did you not cooperate and not meet the ANC, and if so, why?
Cooperative financial institutions. Am I to understand correctly that there's no deposit insurance fund at the moment required from a CFI? And secondly, is there any other prudential requirements placed by the Reserve Bank on CFIs through the agency? So in other words, one rand savings can result in a one rand loan, or do they have a lower ratio of loans to savings? Obviously there's a lot more financial cooperatives in the country. All Stockfels are, by my account, also cooperatives. My understanding is once you hit a million rand level, you are forced to register with the agency and then become an official cooperative financial institution. And to grow this, what we need is to allow cooperatives to become bigger. So internationally it's known that if you want to start a business, basically, you don't go to a bank, you go to friends, family, and fools. But in addition to that, you go to cooperatives or Stockfels. So if we want to grow the economic platform of the country, it's important to grow cooperatives. And to do that, what is your view on the common bond requirement, and can we widen that scope without making the whole nature of a cooperative fall away? And then lastly, just a comment for the cooperative associations. You know, the many banks use other banks' payment mechanism. I'm not sure how the new banks are doing it, but I know that Investec, for instance, uses ABSA Bank. So it's not a train smash to use another bank's payment platforms, because it costs really a lot of money to set up your own thing to do that. I'm sure many of the banks, for instance, in South Africa, don't actually have their own payment mechanism. Last, I think to Nedbank, firstly, it's clear that they seem, and I don't bank with Nedbank, they are the clear leaders in this transformation in the banking industry, so well done to them. And on the matter of the structuring of BEE deals, I'd like your opinion also. The effect of the increase in dividend tax and not having an exemption for BEE deals, is it going to be a detrimental effect to advancing transformation in not only the financial but in all sectors of our country? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right, next please.
Chairperson, I shall be very quick. Just to add to that, it is absolutely clear that Nedbank is, you know, by far the leader in terms of black representation if you look at middle and black top management. Now, if they can do it, why can't the other banks not follow suit? What I want to ask is a simple question. How long shall we wait for a black Mike Brown?
Right.
Thank you, Chair. Right. Thank you to the presenters. Mrs. Mujana spoke about the National Cooperative Bank, and there is no doubt that it's very critical for inclusive economic growth in the country. But please educate me. What is holding it up? I heard you talking about the signing of the legislation, but I just again, please be clear, because I think it is important. It deals with those the people who are marginalised, people who are in the cooperatives, and so on and so forth. That's one. To Nedbank, I would like to hear your view on the once empowered, always empowered concept. You have shared with us what has happened with Nedbank as far as black group empowerment is concerned before. What do you see the role of Nedbank going forward with that project of inclusive growth, economic black group empowerment? We have been dealing with the question of illicit financial flows, and there is no doubt that there are a lot of leakages in our economy, impacting on the economic growth and empowerment and everything. So I would just like to get your experience. If through Nedbank you'd say you have detected some of these things, what has been the role of Nedbank, any mitigating strategies to try and prevent this, because it's very clear that this happens through the banks, but obviously we know that there are complicated schemes and so on, but I just want to hear your mitigating strategies to try and deal with that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Who's next? Floyd. Tandy, I know you're mad with me, Tandy. Tandy's sleeping. I know you're mad with me, it doesn't mean you mustn't ask questions.
Thank you, Chairperson. I see there in the challenges slides, I think it's slide number 21 that I have. The CEO of Nedbank said that stricter targets across codes will lead to lower BBB levels for all going forward. What does that mean? What do you mean by that? Because if you have got legislation or guidance that is not strict, what is the use of having it? That is one. But also I want to... you've made observation that in terms of management, there is a certain degree of change. But in terms of ownership outside of the institutional investors, you said it's just above 5%. And this process that we're engaged in here, mostly to talk about transformation that must speak to de-racialization and high levels of monopoly in that sector, in the banking sector as well. What is your view about what should we do? What direction should we take with regards to the de-racialization of ownership of Nedbank? And that is one thing that would be interested in knowing. But also the Reserve Bank earlier spoke about the advantages and disadvantages of concentration of financial institutions vis-a-vis opening up the space to many other role players. Mm-hmm. what is your view in terms of whether we must have fewer players or we should open up the space for other role players into the banking space? I think that is one of the things that they wanted to get concrete responses on. But I think that, Chair, this process must culminate in a framework that will say we must allow for fair existence of cooperative banks, of state-owned banks, of black-owned banks, and of private banks that have got black ownership within them, significant black ownership and workers' ownership within them. I think that would be the first term that perhaps will make a far much more substantial written submission in terms of how we must get to conclude on some of the issues. I think that we can be able to even propose what form legislation can take to anchor the outcomes of this particular process. Thank you.
June, do you want to ask me?
Thank you, Chair. I have one question for the co-ops in general, the co-op banking system. You've spelt out a very good story to us here, but what would be helpful to me is to get an understanding. I know the co-op bank in Kenya has done exceptionally well, for example, but how much funding is provided by the public sector in Germany as a percentage of the bank's capital, and how much were you envisaging? To Nedbank, it would be useful to get an understanding as to what measures have you got in place to attract savings from an early age right through rather than credit? Thank you.
Sorry, just to say, I think on the cooperative banks thing, I think the committee must give Zakele and Margot considerable attention. I know cooperative falls under, John tells me, the small business part. But as far as the financial side goes, I'm not sure where you fall, but I think you fall under us. But however it is, the two committees might have to meet. But can we signal that, I don't know when we're going to do this, given our load, but sometime in the second half of this year, the latest, we must bring the cooperative banks here before us, bring Treasury and whoever else, trade and a small business development, and look at that sector. If it affects trade and industry, let's look at that sector. I think this should be one of the themes. I also agree with Floyd about the multiplicity of structures we need. And the ones he identifies, actually you might be interested to know, is no different from what the majority parties say. So it's exactly what the ANC also said. So on this thing, please be assured, all of you are here on behalf of the cooperatives, that the committee, the finance committee in particular, but I'm sure that we're very keen on cooperative banks in particular, both on our sector. We need to do more. We haven't done enough, but it's not for lack of a will. It's just we just can't find the time. Then to Nedbank, a question to Mr. Brown. Is there any coincidence between two members of parliament saying you're the most advanced of the banks and the fact that both the chairs are your clients? And one of them is a Politburo member. Don't answer that question. The answer is obvious. Thank you. 1 minute, 37 seconds. I hope one member in particular from our party is noting.
Right. All of this, who started?
He's
the first person that spoke.
Yeah,
I would want to
speak
up. You
want to talk about the question? Yeah, thank you, Chair. Okay, thank you, Chair. The question on the deposit insurance fund, there is an allocation, as far as I know, I think it's only R1 million. It is sitting with CBDA. They have, I think, made some sort of a committee, which is not inclusive of the sector. So it's not functional, it's not operational, as you speak. It's documents that say that. And so there's no current deposit insurance funds in place, but there's talks about it. In terms of prudential requirements, yes, within the rules there are prudential requirements. There's a system called the PEL system that the regulator uses in terms of making sure that your assets and your liquidity all of those indicators are well taken care of and that you are liquid as a cooperative bank. So those legislations are in place. However, we feel that they are not developmental in nature. For instance, within the ratios, it says 5% of your money should be used for non-earning asset, which might be a building, for instance. Now, you find cooperative banks or CFIs that they've only been given a leeway of 5% to acquire a building. Now, if you do not have a proper building, it works as part of the image of a cooperative bank, that you need to have an image that shows that you are also a bank and people can gain trust in terms of the image. So that 5% rule then hinders. And then also as one of the prudential requirements, it says 15%, you can only do up to 15% in terms of accessing external funding. Now, which means now, when I say 15%, I mean 15% of your assets. Now, it means if you are a cooperative bank that has a million rand, it means only 150,000 rand you can only get for external funding. So those are the limitations that you see and create frustrations within the cooperative banks movement, that we are not treated the same as general businesses, we are not treated the same as general banks, and those are legislated. And then the issue of why would cooperative banks not go on maybe an APSA or NetBank banking platform? It's because we've lobbied our government, and when we lobbied our government, the government provided through DEDs and CIF and so on 30 million rand for the development of a banking platform since 2013. And we are sitting here today, there is no fruition or there is no completion of that cooperative bank, I mean of that cooperative banking platform. So the system is not available at 30 million rand down the drain. But I think the CBDA must come and account. Maybe they can give you a better perspective on what happened to that. So we don't want to ride on other people's banking platform, because now when they want to take you off, they can take you off and close you down. So that's the reason. And then in terms of registration of a cooperative bank or of a CFI, legislation says you need to have
about half a minute.
200 members, and then once you reach the 1 million rand mark, then you can go to the Reserve Bank, but there's also a lot of requirements that you need to go through. So hence we have two, but they're still not even on the national payment system. I think that covers the questions that I noted.
Okay. What is holding up the establishment of a national co-op bank? In terms of the Cooperative Banks Act, except for obvious certain barriers that he's just alluded to, it takes very long to get to a national bank. That's the one part. However, because we are wanting to set this up as a national apex, that part of the legislation, that two pieces of legislation, the one legislation provides for the setting up. However, the other piece of legislation, which brings into being apex organization, has not been, the regulations have not been signed. So that is a serious constraint currently. Another question? Oh, okay. All right. I think we'll appreciate that was a commitment that you've made, and we really appreciate the fact that you can focus some time and bring us all here, you know, so that we have meaningful discussions and take forward the whole cooperative bank ecosystem in the country. The other comment related to Stokvels. Not all Stokvels are banks. A Stokvel is a Stokvel. The two are very different. They're really not the same. I think those were the questions and remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. The DGRB.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. So how much is needed to support viable cooperative banks? So my answer is they need a proper buy-in from groups of the society. So the government at all, and then the business sector and the private sector. So the business sector, I mean also the banks, because they have the knowledge. They do a lot for, you know, inclusion and what else. But they should help, because they have knowledge to establish a cooperative system, because at the end the whole society is much better, it's balanced, and it will be a win-win situation. So they should come in and help. So a whole strategy for 3 to 5 years is necessary, and then if you start a business, you know, a student who studies economics, he knows that they need three things if you start a business. First, human. Second, asset. And then third, capital. So these three issues have to be supported and to establish good cooperative banks in each and every municipality. So when a crisis has a tragedy, in each and every municipality, one cooperative bank. And then the people that can participate, and then you build a society out of the ground. So the whole majority of the disadvantaged people, black, white, and what else, they have the power to help themselves. So this would be our recommendations. And then to initiate also, in Germany, to initiate savings, mobilization. So for example, the government very often, they give some percentage, 5%, 10%, if you save for a long time. So this also would help to save. And then you get rid of the foreign capital, which is needed in South Africa, because you depend at the moment on foreign capital. With the savings mobilization, you get rid of it. And the cooperative bank can assist to it. So if you establish a good cooperative bank, so the whole society will benefit. You have less crime, less joblessness. Thank you.
Right, thank you. I think I've got 7 questions that I need to deal with. So firstly, to Honourable Manier, I think generally as an organisation, Nedbank is an organisation that doesn't refuse to meet people, and we value dialogue. So yes, we did meet with the ANC, as we met with the IMC, as I'm sure you've read from our affidavit. Clearly, what was discussed in that meeting was nothing to do with individual accounts. We discussed generally the regulation pertaining to banks, and in particular, a regulation called Guidance Note 23, which I'm sure you know well, as well as the case law around closing accounts, Standard Bank versus Bread and Company being the key case there. Honourable Topham, in respect of dividend tax, clearly to the extent that leveraged BEE deals are done in listed companies, the financing of those is effectively, on the one hand, growth in the share price and dividends relative to a funding cost on the other hand. That's what creates value. So to the extent that dividends are depleted by an increased dividend withholding tax, that would clearly make those deals less attractive. To the extent that BEE deals are done perhaps in the non-listed space and are done through mechanisms like leverage buyouts, then clearly the dividends are not applicable because the debt is in the belly of the company as opposed to at a shareholder level. Honourable Buthelezi, just in terms of once empowered, always empowered, we would believe that is a valid proposition in an entity with regulated capital. You heard one of our predecessors talk about the fact that if a bank finances its own BEE deal, like we all did, that financing sterilizes the regulated capital base of the bank, which means we have less money to lend to the economy. So it takes away from the productive capacity of the economy. I think it also, if one of our BEE shareholders cashes in and either sells to an institution or uses that cash to buy a big stake in another black bank, I think that it would be inappropriate for them or Nedbank to be prejudiced in that process. On the role of Nedbank going forward, certainly we know that our business does need to continue to transform and to continue to play a catalytic role in South African society, as you've seen us do on many occasions and in our interaction at the CEO's initiative. On illicit flows, all big businesses have very large risk management frameworks in place. If you just take our business Over the last 3 years, we would have invested roughly R1 billion on detection mechanisms, people, software, and infrastructure around anti-money laundering and our ability to detect and report on that. It's not always easy for a bank to know exactly what flows going through its customers' accounts are being used for, but certainly we have a dedicated financial crime unit in the bank headed by very competent people, and wherever we see any illicit or suspicious activity, we report that as required to the FIC. To Honourable Shabambu, what is meant by the codes, the higher codes, meaning that our scores are lower? I think really what I'm trying to point out is that as we motivate our people and organisation to achieve higher levels and higher targets, if the targets keep shifting, it's very difficult to say to people, you've done better, but our score has got worse, because the target against which we're measuring has become a higher target. So it's really in the messaging and motivation of people. In terms of ownership...
You got a few seconds left, the entire... But we'll give you 30 seconds.
Okay. In terms of ownership, I think that we do need to focus on ownership, institutional ownership, who can be active owners of a bank, and who sits behind those institutional owners, and what are the racial makeup of those indirect owners, because banks generally are not directly owned by individuals, as we've seen. To get more players in the market, we certainly believe that competition is good for South Africa, and competition is good for all of us. Good players make a good, strong competition makes all of our businesses much stronger. I think something the committee should focus its time and energy on as a suggestion would be the progression of deposit insurance, because I think the challenges that small banks have is raising deposits. People want to put their deposits with a big, strong bank, not with a bank that deposit may not be paid back to them, as we saw in the case of African Bank, and people had to step in. So deposit insurance, I think, would be good to promote competition. The challenge is who funds that deposit insurance. And then finally, for Honourable Fubs, I don't have all of the measures that we have in place for entry-level banking and youth, but would certainly concur that in a highly indebted society, we have a very large focus on the importance of savings.
Right. Now, just very quickly, Finmark Trust fell away, so we've got an extra 15 minutes before lunch at 13:15, so we're suggesting the South African Insurance Association comes in. But are there any other questions quickly, because we have a bit of time? No. Can I just ask a question very quickly? This came up when we were finalizing the Financial Sector Regulation Bill as well, without referring to the merits of any particular case, like the Oakbay one. The question that preoccupied members then, and it seems reasonable, and you may not be able to answer it, we wanted to ask the Banking Association last time, but there wasn't time. Why do banks refuse to tell a client in a closed room, with their lawyer there and the client's lawyer there, need be, why they close people's accounts? It could be a low-income earner whose account you've closed. What is the problem in telling them? I'm not saying reveal it in public if any member asks the question. What's the problem in telling them?
So I think if you read the affidavit that Nedbank submitted in that particular case, you'll see we did meet with that client and we did tell them, and there's a letter appended to that affidavit that sets out the reasons we closed the account.
So there's no international regulation that prohibits that, right?
Not that I'm aware of. I'm not a lawyer, but we certainly met individually with the
client. The banking people who were in the committee at the time, they were unhappy about that provision. We decided as a committee, you'll recall, because it came at the very last minute, as the Conduct of Financial Institutions Bill coming up, we will put it in there. You know. Then the other thing, just to alert you if you don't already know, illicit financial flows is a very big concern of this committee. And while we accept what you said, it's still true that large chunks are going out. I won't quote those figures. They're horrific. One figure I can recall is $122 billion between 203 and 212. And we really feel the banks, as well as a whole number of other related institutions, have to do far more. We have to do far more. Abba Omar, you hear from Basa, right, and others. That thing, really we're going to harass you people, really, apart from FIC and others. Thank you very much. Over then, South African Insurance Association. Where are you? Are you here? Thank you.
as honorable members of the two portfolio committees. My name is Laila Munja. I'm going to be talking on behalf of Short-Term Insurers today. I am the general manager for governance and transformation at SAIA, and I am accompanied by our CEO, Mr. Pearson. To start off, I just want to position where short-term insurers sit within the economy and our role in the economy. Short-term insurers provide policies against losses. So we insure people against sustained losses if something bad happens to them. What has been said about short-term insurers is that we are the grease that makes the economy work. So people are willing to take out savings to go into business because they have some sort of comfort that if something goes wrong, there is a short-term insurance policy to back them up in the event of that unfortunate situation. The industry contributes roughly 3% to the GDP. In 2015, local gross written premiums amounted to 108 billion rand, of which 56%, 61 billion rand, was paid out in claims. 87% of that related to property, transport, and motor claims. Over the last 10 years, 61.6% of all premiums taken by the insurance companies were paid back into the economy via claims expenses. Just in terms of what the industry looks like, there are 74 short-term insurance companies. This is in relation to the 99 insurance licenses. There are companies that hold more than one license. So even though there's 99 licenses, there's actually 74 insurance companies. 31 of those companies offer products in only one or two segments of insurance. 36 in three or more segments, and there are 7 insurers who offer insurance against all products. 6 insurers are state-owned. 14 insurance companies are captive insurance. That means they only insure the assets of their holding companies. The market share of the top 6 insurance companies is 56%, and the market share of the top 10 insurance companies is 66%. In terms of transformation and short-term insurance, our members are committed to growing an inclusive economy. We are committed to enhancing the resilience of communities and societies in general, thereby facilitating and supporting sustainable development. We are committed to broad-based socio-economic transformation for the benefit of all South Africans and to the vision of the National Development Plan. We believe that by doing that, we not only enhance South Africa, but we also enhance our own companies. I'm going to talk about the industry performance against the FSC. In terms of ownership, as an industry average, we are 18.97% black-owned against a target of 25%. This is measured using the methodologies of the FSC, which is not that different to the DTI bills. It does include ownership by mandated investments, indirect ownership, pension funds, retirement funds, employee share options. 8.49% of the industry is owned by black women and 5.10% by black designated groups, which are rural, youth, people with disabilities, that sort of thing. The largest short-term insurer is 28% black-owned. The highest black ownership, this is excluding companies that are 100% black-owned, is 63%. These figures exclude the state-owned insurers, okay, which are Sasria, the Land Bank, Kula, GainSecure, which is the NAL, Export Credit Insurance Corporation, and ESCAP, which is ESCOM's insurance company. They also exclude figures owned by the banks, because that would be reflected in the bank's figures, as well as those companies owned by the long-term insurers, because that would be reflected in their figures. So we didn't want to duplicate figures. In terms of management control and skills development, I think as an industry, we are cognizant of the fact that especially in terms of executive and senior management positions, we aren't doing as well as what the targets are. We are doing well in terms of lower management levels, and we are committed to working towards improving our senior management figures. So in terms of that, we are committed to training of all staff to enhance our management level, and you will see, particularly in terms of learnerships, we far exceed the targets because we believe that bringing people into the industry growing them is a far more sustainable way of doing creating the pipeline. In 2016, the industry took on 1,256 learners, of which 59% were black female and 39% were black male. In 2016, 23 of the insurance companies had graduate recruitment programs for black new graduates. 424 black youth were given bursaries to studies at universities and TVET colleges, of which 52% were aimed at black women. In terms of enterprise and supply development, in terms of BE spend with all suppliers, we have a figure of 79.72%, which is higher than the 70% current target in the BE in the FSC, and is almost at the level of the new FSC's target of 80%. 23.71% of all procurement goes towards suppliers who are considered to be EMEs and QSEs. 12.52% is with black-owned, more than 50% black-owned companies. 4.41% is with 30% black women-owned companies. We do understand that there is generally a problem with black women-owned businesses that just don't exist in certain industries. And to that end, members are committed to creating those businesses. So you will see in terms of enterprise development spend, 4.91% of companies' net profit after tax is spent developing black-owned businesses with a big focus on developing black women-owned businesses. In the last 3 years, members have spent in excess of 373 billion developing 1,829 black suppliers who employ collectively 29,771 people. In terms of motor body repair spend, which is one of our biggest areas, motor insurance accounts for 45% of the industry roughly. The spend that actually goes to the motor body repairers. It's not the total motor claim spend, which is made up of cash where cars are stolen or written off, repairs, which are what the industry refers to as yellow metal claims, which refers to your industrial construction, those sort of rather big, you see them all over the place, big yellow vehicles. It excludes car hire warranties, that sort of thing. So actual spend that goes towards motor body repairs. 51%, the industry spent over R1 billion in 2016, increased from 890 million in 2015 and 649 in 2014. So there's a very concerted effort within the insurance companies to spend more with black-owned motor body repairers. You'll see, in terms of 51% black-owned businesses, 21% of all motor body repair claims go towards 51% black-owned repairers, and 82% of that goes towards companies who have a BE level between 1 and 4. In terms of financial literacy, the industry spent 0.43% in 2016 of its net profit after tax doing financial literacy initiatives. The SAIR started its initiative in 2004. To date, just as the industry initiative, we spent R126 million doing financial literacy programs, of which R60 million was spent at school level in conjunction with the Department of Basic Education, putting financial literacy into the school curriculum. So to teach children how to save, what is the importance of saving, how to try and avoid debt, those are the sort of programs we focus on in terms of financial literacy. It's important to note that financial literacy, as contained in the Financial Sector Code, is not the requirements of what's either in the National Credit Act or the Consumer Protection Act. This is looking at financial literacy broadly to try and encourage savings, encourage people to budget. It's trying to shift towards a less debt-burdened society. That's the idea of what financial literacy is. As I said, we spent R126 million as an industry. In addition, in 2015, members spent R13.5 million. In terms of socioeconomic development, the industry has spent in 2016 2.62% of net profit after tax. This is against the target of 0.6%. It's because we do believe that is something that's crucial to actually changing the economy and to create sustainable development. You'll notice of the 2.62%, roughly 65% was spent on education initiatives. That is because we believe education is key to long-term sustainability and socio-economic development. It's the key to bringing people out of poverty. So it's where we believe we can make a big difference. 26% of our socio-economic development funds is also spent on food and agriculture and health programs, because we believe that as an economy, that's also where we have gaps. In terms of financial inclusion, I think as an industry, we are cognizant of bank. This is where we have probably struggled the most, and there's various reasons for that, mostly because short-term insurance, to a large extent, we still believe is a grudge purchase. People don't like buying short-term insurance. There's also a trust deficit within the industry. And the one thing that is, I think it's a given that when people face financial hardships, the first thing they do is cancel their car insurance and their home insurance policies. So what we have seen through the Finmark studies is that there was an increase in financial inclusion in terms of short-term insurance policies up to 2008, 2009, and then following the global financial crisis, there was certainly a regression where we see less people actually holding short-term insurance policies. That isn't just in terms of the financial inclusion space in that target market, but across the sector. So you'll see, in 2004, there were 2.1 million people who had short-term insurance, motor vehicle insurance.
You have 3 minutes left.
That figure increased to 3.2 in 2014, and as I said, there's since been a regression. As an industry, we are committed to working with stakeholders to try and change this. We do understand that because of the role short-term insurance plays in the economy, it is important to ensure a greater portion of the population. In terms of some of the other projects we focus on, in terms of socio-economic transformation, we will be launching later this year with other stakeholders in the industry, a college of insurance at a local in terms of Gauteng, TVET college, to try and bring more people into studying insurance as a core curriculum to bring them into the industry. We have what's called the Motor Transformation and Sustainability Forum that's working with panel beaters to try and increase spend with black panel beaters. We work with various bodies in terms of crime combating and reduction, particularly business against crime. We have what's called a Partnership for Risk and Resilience, working with local municipalities to upskill them and work on their own risk and resilience in develop with their communities. There's something called the Youth Accelerator, Youth Employment Accelerator, that works with bringing youth not only to the insurance industry, but to the economy as a whole. We've recently launched something called the Business for Road Safety Forum. The Minister of Finance announced in his budget speech the Agricultural Insurance Public-Private Partnership, which we've been working on for the last 2.5 years or so. And we're working with the Department of Energy on something called the Green Diesel Replacement Program as part of a climate change initiative. So the focus areas is the industry is committed to broad-based socio-economic transformation and to contribute to the NDP implementation. We believe collaboration is important, and we are committed to working with all stakeholders towards our transformation journey. One of the key focus areas will be on demographic representation of staff, particularly at senior middle management levels. We are committed to increasing procurement with black-owned businesses, smaller black businesses, and black women-owned businesses, and to work towards increasing financial inclusion and financial literacy levels. The next step in terms of our financial transformation journey is as an industry, we'll be implementing an enterprise and supply development program, particularly focused on black panel beaters. As I said, we will be launching the College of Insurance later this year once the Department of Higher Education and Training has approved the modules. We're committed to regularly monitoring insurer procurement spend because that is where we believe we have the greatest impact on the economy. And over and above the targets contained in the Financial Sector Code, we are committed to monitoring spend with more than 75% black-owned suppliers. We are...
You have 15 minutes, 30 seconds
more. So we're just going to ask the question.
Yeah.
We will investigate ways to support the establishment of black insurance, and through the Financial Inclusion Forum with the Department of Treasury, with Jasper Treasury and the FSB, we'll investigate ways to increase financial inclusion.
Thank you. We'll come back at 1:45, half an hour lunch, but can the Finance Committee remain behind for a few minutes? Alan, can you distribute the two programs to the Finance Committee?